Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, August 3rd, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live not steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA, but instead, the other heartland of America, at least for today, ladies and gentlemen, and that is in New Orleans, Louisiana. In the New Orleans Convention Center? I never even asked what the name of the convention center was. The home of Netroots Nation 2018. I am in the Netroots Nation town square, as it were, watching Cory Booker take a selfie with an adoring fan. But more importantly, I am at the moment sitting across from Alex Lawson, the executive director of Social Security Works, old friend of the show, and we will have on the program today a series of guests. And let me just start with a little bit of house cleaning. Oh, wow, look at this! Like Cory Booker is really attractive.
It's going to be a whole thing.
This is terribly exciting. I'm almost tempted to turn the camera over to show people. I feel like I'm the least excited person in the entire hall. I don't know, but I'll ask Alex where he's at this. But today on the program, we're going to have another, just by deign of scheduling, it's weird. I've done a lot of pre-tapes. All my pre-tapes were women, and almost all the men on the live show, all the people on the live show are going to be men. And so we do have a pre-record with Deb Haaland. She's running for Congress in New Mexico's 1st District, if I remember correctly. And she could very well be the first Native American woman elected to Congress. Interesting talk with her. We're going to run that a little bit later. I'm looking right now at the guy who played Bowser on Sha-Na-Na. We had dinner. Alex Lawson, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Alex, let's talk a little bit about, let's do a little bit of the meta thing about Netroots Nation, because we were talking a little bit before about, you know, and particularly as it deals with Social Security Works. I think the first time you and I met was at Netroots Nation at a presentation that you were giving.
It's true.
Yeah, we've talked about this on air, but this story always is fun for me. But yeah, let's talk about that moment. You were giving a talk, and there was a broad coalition, because this is coming out of, this was in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And
the turn to austerity had just happened. You know, you had Obama's State of the Union talking about austerity. We saw what was coming. There is the Bull-Simpson Commission, the BS Commission. We knew what their BS report would be. It would be cuts to Social Security. It would be the so-called grand bargain, you know, the grand betrayal. So we had spent a ton of time setting up this whole coalition. And it was a coalition, so we didn't have total control over the messaging.
I remember that, yes.
And actually, just to tell the whole story, AARP was really adamant on some of the messaging, including the name of the coalition being Strengthen Social Security. And it was a big negotiation, and I was like, no, we need to add don't cut it, because we don't want to, and it was a whole thing, and we launched it at Netroots Nation, and everyone was with us, except for one guy who stood up and asked the first question, which was you.
Yes, and I think I was like, well, I mean, and you knew this, obviously.
We did.
And I didn't realize, you know, I didn't know you, and I would have been probably a little more circumspect with my critique. But I was like, strengthen Social Security. That's what they claim they're doing by cutting it. That's always the line. We're going to strengthen Social Security by cutting it now so that it exists later. And we all knew it was BS, but that's...
You literally zeroed in on the exact problem with a lot of, you know, so-called left or defenders of Social Security. They would walk right into the right-wing frame, you know? Like, they would say, we need to strengthen Social Security, which obviously says that it's weak, right? If you right. need to strengthen it. And which is why we added the dot, 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 don't cut it, because... And that was the compromise position. And you literally hit that one note.
The dot, dot, dot was off the bumper sticker, essentially.
And right? our name is Social Security Works,
right.
which is actually the brand that we wanted, and the compromise was the coalition would have a different name, but Social Security Works is the message that we carry, because Social Security works. It works perfect. It works exactly as it's set up. The only problem with Social Security is that benefits are far too low for millions of people, so we fight to expand Social Security, and, you know, we actually have tried to change the name of the coalition along the way to the Expand Social Security Coalition. And it's, you know, it's a process. I bet
right.
we're going to end there.
But what's fascinating about that process is that we have come so far. I mean, we were just talking about this beforehand. So that was, what, 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we were worried about a Democratic president cutting Social Security.
At that time, we could only get Bernie Sanders, Keith Ellison, Raul Grijalva, and John Conyers on a pledge against all cuts. That's where we were. And we were there in that holding pattern with four members of Congress, just getting them to absolutely no cuts. We were there for a while before we started building the momentum. That, you know, actually then we got them to no cuts, and we immediately, you know, we started fighting as for expansion, saying, you know, we don't need to just defend. And this is the strategic move, you know, like if you're on defense, you've got to win 100% of the time, which is why you got to go on offense, fight for what you want. You don't fight against you. Fighting for what you want naturally fights against the things that you're defending.
Right.
But when you're fighting to expand Social Security, you can lose all the time. And if you win, you get what you want.
Right.
And a loss is maintaining the status quo.
Do you think, broadly speaking, and now, of course, I think the last we had was the last Senate, the last...
85% of the Democratic caucus in the Senate and the House are on vehicles to expand Social Security. It is the mainstream center Democratic position.
Do you think that that lesson that you've just articulated about going on the offense, right? Because Democrats, largely speaking, the left in the past, I mean, I think we're seeing something different happen right now. We'll talk about that. But they've never operated in that fashion.
Well, what, I would do is
in our lifetime.
Exactly. I would say, first of all, that we're old.
Right.
And I think what you're talking about, I would say that it was the Democrats or the Democratic Party who was really on that, like, meek sort of defense. And the left, broadly, was shut out of the discussion.
Right.
And
because, right.
you know, we've been, there has always been a left who are saying, you know, like at this conference, saying
yes.
we have to be bold. We have to fight for what we want. We only lose when we forget what we're fighting for. But the party levers of power were definitely controlled by aim low Democrats, aim low consultants.
It still is.
It still is.
Right.
But
I mean,
there's a strong, the left has a voice now, right? I mean, like, your show, Truth Tellers, like here on Radio
well,
Row.
We're also, we're seeing it with electeds now.
Exactly.
Like we're seeing it with, like, you know, Bernie Sanders has a...
Bernie Sanders, that changed
everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
It really did. And now, you know, Social Security Works has a PAC, and John Bowser Bauman, Bowser from Sha-na-na,
yeah.
He goes around the country. He's doing 56 events and endorsement events. And we get questionnaires and, you know, expanding Medicare, expanding Social Security, taking federal action to lower prescription drug prices. That's like a baseline.
Right.
And I think it's almost, I love it because the left is hungry. And so they're not going to just accept that. But I also, from my perspective, take a moment and I'm like, wow, have we come far just from like 3 years ago? You know, it's
that's,
amazing.
That's what I look, and that's what I mean. You can see half of the people in the studio right now, and that is like what I'm trying to, you know, I explain to these guys, like, you don't understand how fast, like, the rate of acceleration, and maybe this is how it works, right? Like, you have, because
can I tell a story on it?
Please.
You build, you prepare, and when change happens, it does happen fast. I literally moved to Washington, D.C. and got my master's to fight against pharmaceutical monopolies, which are one of the real reasons and main causes that healthcare is unaffordable, right? Why we can't guarantee healthcare to everyone, why there aren't drugs produced based on public need, but instead on private greed. And I've been working on this for over a decade. And I worked on one bill recently. I worked on it for 2 years. It's a Medicare negotiation bill that has a component in it, a competitive licensing component, which would allow generic competition of branded drugs. And that is a game-changing policy. And it has always hit a wall, right? Like, oh, yeah, I'm with you, but I don't want to get too far. 85 co-sponsors on this Medicare negotiation bill with competitive licensing in it. This is now the absolute, like, center of the Democratic caucus in the House, who, if we take power, it's almost, the Houses are more likely to get gavels than the Senate, are more likely to have power. And that bill could actually move. It was a fantasy.
Right.
3 years ago, literally, like, you could talk to people, you know, they'd be on your side, but they're like, it's just not going to fly in the caucus. Like, there's no way you're going to get, you know, a lot of support. 85 Democrats, which is twice as many as the last Medicare negotiation, which is just obvious policy, right? You allow
right.
Medicare to negotiate
right.
drug prices.
Right.
It's actually one of the most corrupt stories in Washington, D.C., is why Medicare can't. Billy Towson changed parties to get Medicare Part D, the drug, through, and his
then,
whole role was to not allow them to negotiate drug prices, and then he took $1 million
a month later. He announces, after that bill passes, he announces, I'm going to work for pharma.
I'm literally going to run pharma for $1 million a year. It was his whole
so corrupt.
Reason that he was there was for that.
I feel like stories like that need to be highlighted more, just to understand the era we're living in with, like, Donald Trump. Like,
yeah.
If you understand the motivation of a guy like Townsend, you can understand, like, how a guy like Donald Trump views government and the people around it. Just, like, this is just a business. It's just like I'm bending the rules on the margins. Like, you know, it's mostly a new car that I'm selling, or whatever, you know, whatever, like, just like a slightly bending the rules. It's just a leverage point. I'm going to become, you know, go into public service as a way of, you know, I'm going to meet people and network and blah, 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 and this and that. And that's basically, if you understand Townsend, you understand, I think, the Trump administration.
He was putting in time for his actual job. His job wasn't in Congress. His job was that seat at pharma.
Yep.
And he knew it. And he literally switched parties so that he would still be in the game for the bill that got him the $1 million a year payoff. And that is the corrupt mentality that, I mean, it also has accelerated, though. I mean, like, it's now openly corrupt, right? Like,
yeah.
Alex Azar is running HHS. Alex Azar, who used to be the CEO of Eli Lilly. He's the guy that's raised insulin prices. He's the guy, deaths are at his feet.
Yeah.
People have died because of his greed. And he's the guy who's supposed to be in charge of lowering drug prices for people. Like, no, he's the guy who is going to steal public money and put it directly into the pockets of Wall Street investors.
I mean, I think it's just hard for average people to sort of understand that. Like, just wrap their heads around that.
Well,
right? Like, it's easier to understand, like, a person who robs a bank than somebody who, like, goes through all these machinations and will do this, you know, because at least, you know, a bank robber theoretically they wear a mask or something, right? Like they just they're you know, they know they don't want to be known for that.
But the Steel Big people just do it right openly.
Yeah, I know.
Tell you the thing, it's the buy-in. So like people I think understand the sellout leaving, like Billy Towson leaving government to go run pharma, but I think what people should really watch is the buy-in, the other side. It's the other half of corruption. Why would somebody leave as the CEO of Eli Lilly to take a massive pay cut to serve the public? You're like, because they're not.
It's an investment in themselves.
And he's going to go right back to Eli Lilly, and they're actually going to pay him for the time that he was in government giving our money away.
It's an investment in themselves. It's, you know, you gotta take this time for you.
But they only have one game plan. It's literally robbing the public, right? Like, what's their plan with Social Security? They want to reach into our pocket and rob us. They want to steal our money. What's their plan with Medicare? They want to reach into our pockets and rob us. They want to steal our health care. They've only got one plan. That's it. It's just a wholesale looting of the public.
Do you think that I know the Democrats have sort of have, I think they have settled on a corruption theme for this. I mean, partly because we remember in 2006, I mean, I think a lot of people forget this. There's a perception that some people have that it was a reaction to the war. But it really was, broadly speaking, a lot. I mean, Townsend was actually an issue. Was the corruption.
What was the dude, the Dukester, or right? Like that was an M.
Duke Cunningham, right? Right. Who, and Bob Ney. I mean, there was all these different stories of corruption that culminated in the Republican leadership, and we didn't really know exactly how problematic the Republican leadership was at that time. I think it was Denny Hastert covering for Mark Foley, who was a predator. On pages, and that was like the final weeks of the campaign where like their corruption just became so naked and gross that I think I haven't seen the Democrats on a national level.
I want to say one other thing though.
Please.
And I know you know this, but because there's always, it's always multiple things. But the other thing was that George W. Bush, who didn't run on it at all, right after he got power, he was going to implement Wall Street's number one plan, which was to privatize Social Security. And the you know, the movement that formed against that tanked his popularity. And the movement that formed against it said, we'll pay for your tour, George W. Bush. We'll send you around the country to talk about your plan to privatize Social Security, because the more you talk about it, the more people hate you.
That just to walk down memory lane, it was Talking Points Memo. Actually was one of the lead sites because they encouraged their readers to go and get their local congressperson on record as to where they were on that privatization bill, and it scared the hell out of
them. And they ran a whip. They actually had a public whip sheet, meaning who is where.
And that scared the hell out of them. And I just remember George Bush in a storage room surrounded by file cabinets, going like, you know, there's no money here. It's just an IOU, and that's it. And the Social Security Trust Fund, and it was.
And you're like, those are just bonds, like the same bonds that Goldman Sachs owns, the same bonds that grandmothers buy for their kids. That is the base of our system.
It was such low hanging fruit to just say like, do you think your actual dollars that you gave your bank are in there? Like when you came in and like, here's $100 that I am depositing in bills. Like, do you think they're actually sitting in the bank? They're like, we got to leave this. This is Sam's money. And we have it in an envelope in the safety deposit.
Well, I mean, W might have believed that. I'm not going to.
But it was that talking point. It took a while for that to die. Just like it's just an IOU.
Actually, that talking point, I should flack Nancy's new book, The Truth About Social Security. That talking point has never left. And that talking point was originated literally with Alf Landon, who ran against FDR on an anti-Social Security platform of it's all worthless IOUs. They literally didn't even update their talking points for 80 years. Now, importantly, Alf Landon lost every single state except for one in that race. Because Social Security has, even right after it was formed, people understood the power and the social good, that when we're working together, what we can do is impossible. It's literally impossible in any other form.
Why do you think the Democrats never learned the singular lesson about Social Security, that its universality makes it so durable that 80 years later, they can't even come up with a new line to attack it? Like, I mean, in terms of policy durability, I mean, that's the interesting thing that's happened with the Affordable Care Act. It has taught the other side of that lesson.
Yeah.
Like, you can do this sort of, like, statutory framework, and they just say, like, well, okay, we're going to have HHS do all these different regulations that are going to make this sort of very kludgy piece of legislation work, and it's going to be this for those people and that for these people.
And it's going to rely on the private insurers, and they've got to be good actors.
And so there's got to be all these sort of machinations, and then you just see, like, oh, Trump pulls two or three, you know, like, little straws out of the Jenga thing, and it starts to crumble. Or the Supreme Court knocks this and, you know, a million people don't get Medicaid. I feel like on some level, like, they're learning the lesson on that end. Like, it's almost impossible to argue for something structurally as opposed to Medicare for All, which is just like, here's the law.
And the other lesson that I think they have learned, and, you know, there's always a lot of learning that the Democrats can do, is that small, right? Like, the theory, and I was there, the theory on just, like, doing a little bit was, otherwise the Republicans are going to literally run against this policy for 8 years as a government takeover of healthcare. That's why we can't fight for, that's why we've got to do this. We got to actually give them what they want, and then they won't. And you're like, they literally ran against their own ideas, because it was just making people buy private insurance, yeah, and then giving them money to do it if they couldn't. And the best part, the most durable part, was the expanding Medicaid.
Right.
But they learned that the Republicans are going to attack that. It doesn't matter what you do. They're going to call it, and they're going to throw everything they have at it no matter what. So you should at least fight for the policy that you actually want.
Right.
Because that's the same opposition that you're going to get no matter what.
Right. And the problem is that you've got the Republicans saying you're giving these folks all this stuff and it's horrible. And then the folks don't even get the stuff that they're being accused of having gotten. And
right.
They're like, what we got sucks. And maybe the Republicans are right.
And
on
they
something.
Exactly. And they blame a so-called thing called Obamacare. And you're like, for rising premiums, instead of being like, you know, who is raising the premiums is the private insurers,
right,
who have never stopped being terrible. They're bad actors. They always will be bad actors. You know, we can go on forever on the wonkiness here, but it's literally true that the private insurance companies cannot make money unless they're bad actors. They make money by taking your premiums and denying you care.
That's what Wendell Potter...
Or it's not profitable.
Yes,
like, there's literally no way that they can be profitable other than ripping you off.
Years ago, Wendell Potter was saying, like, this is not... The business model is not... There's no business model here. It's not a real business model. I mean, on some level, like, you could track Joe Lieberman's... Because at one point, Joe Lieberman was in favor of a buy-in at 55, a Medicare buy-in at 55. And that was because if you took people ages 55 to 65 out of the risk pool, right, it becomes a much more viable product for insurance companies.
And especially a buy-in, which would have massive adverse selection, right? So the people who need a guaranteed program, Medicare, are going to be, so the people who have the most illness, are the sickest, have the largest disease burdens, are going to be the ones who move to Medicare.
Right. That's what adverse selection means for folks. So that you're talking about, there's two different risk pools. There's one for the private insurance and one for Medicare. And all the sick people, first of all, you're getting all the old people who tend to be more sick, not always, but tend to be.
No, but I mean, like, that's why Medicare exists. Just
right.
As they didn't, like, say, hey, we should give seniors health insurance because we're nice people. The actuaries would say to private insurers, as soon as a person turns 65, figure out a way to throw them off the rolls because they are unaffordable. And if you have seniors on a private roll, your system will implode.
And then the
so
idea
people were uninsured.
And then the idea of doing that at 55, not only you're getting even, you know, the next cohort of oldest people, but all those people who are sick, they're definitely going to go into Medicare because they want it guaranteed. Then you're left with people 55 and under who are relatively healthy.
I just have to do this one thing just because you've set it up so well. That's why the buy-in is a BS plan. That's why, because the buy-in says some people in this age cohort are going to go into Medicare, and it's going to be the people who need the guaranteed health care. If you just lower the age, statutorily say everyone 55 and over is now in Medicare, everyone, so you just lower the age of eligibility, what that does is it Medicare increases, the costs of Medicare go down because you add younger people into that risk
pool. And you add healthier people.
Exactly.
And if you have a risk pool where there's a proper distribution between healthy people and sick people, the prices go down.
And lowering the age is a path. You can just, right, go to 55, then to 45, then to 35, until you get to zero.
On some level, that's what's going to happen, it seems to me, that as we start to see the rollout of Medicare for All plans, and this thing becomes real rather than a, you know, rhetoric, that we're in a position where we do ultimately, hopefully, get to a Democratic Senate, a Democratic House, and a Democratic president, we're going to see the Medicare for All, and the plan's going to look like something like, in year one, we go down to 55, and in year one, we also, like, well, the first 10 years of life, let's say. So it's 10-year-olds.
Which is actually what The Truth About Social Security by Nancy Altman is publishing on August 14th on Social Security's birthday. It's the actual story of Social Security. And the original conception of Social Security had a guaranteed health plan in it. The original conception of Social Security is much bigger than what people kind of think of as Social Security. It was guaranteed economic security from cradle to grave and included a guaranteed health plan. That was cut out because of, you know, the opposition that existed then. The next iteration was actually Medicare and Medikids, so seniors and kids. And then the conception was you just lower and raise and meet in the middle.
Close the gap.
And you just squeeze the private insurers in the middle. Dingell, senior, actually was one of the key, you know, he was one of the key leaders on that push. It's in the book. His son, Dingell Jr. from Michigan, he was signed Medicare into law. He's what, you know, one of the he got a signing pen. He was one of the main people who pushed that. His wife, Debbie Dingell, who took that seat in Michigan, is currently one of the co-chairs of the Medicare for All caucus. It's literally one family that traces the 80 years that we've been fighting.
That's
for this.
Amazing.
And you can put it into, we've been fighting for national health care for 112 years, somewhere in there, over a century. We've been pushing for this because it's such an obvious thing, and it's the only way that can actually work is through a social insurance setup.
It's pretty exciting because I feel like we're...
I think it's 72 people in the Medicare for All caucus. Again, that acceleration, you would not have guessed that level, like just 3 years ago, that over 70 members of the House would be in this caucus.
Yeah, and I think a large part of that is just is Bernie Sanders introducing this whole thing to the crowd. Oh, here, yeah, Michael Signorelli is sitting down with us now. Let me just power up your mic, Mike. Let me just hear you say hello.
Hello, Sam. How you doing?
Now, you know Alex, right?
Hello. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Michael Signorelli on Progress. What is it? 167?
127.
127.
Sirius XM Progress, 127.
All right. Now, I want you to listen to this. Now that I got you both, we're, you know, folks, we'll put a link to Nancy Altman's book. Is it pre-sales now?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Stick around because I want you to hear this. It's pretty funny. Do you have a set of headphones? Do you? Like just iPhone headphones or something? No? Does he really want to? Okay. All right. I don't know if... I just want you guys to hear this clip. I have a feeling, Michael, that you've probably heard this clip.
You might need to slide over.
Hold on. I'll put this on the other side here. Just bear with us, folks. This is the way you do live.
Hold on
one second. Let me get this. Bear with us. Play some music in the studio or something as we do this. You know,
why
really
would we play music?
This
is electrifying radio. This is how it happens. This is the behind-the-scenes process where
a shared listener
three
of Michael and I. Wait a second. Let me just do this.
Thanks, Jay.
I want you guys to hear this because this is we've been having a fairly substantive policy conversation for the past 20 minutes. Getting animated about it, excited about it, talking about how the Republicans, when they talk about things like fighting Social Security, they've been having the same talking points for 80 years.
Yeah.
Right.
I want you to hear from, and this is very straight, this is Donald Trump had a rally last night in, I think it was in, Pennsylvania. And CNN went out to go ask questions of the QAnon movement people, as they call themselves, as if this is a movement. And listen to some of the reasoning behind this movement. Are you familiar with QAnon?
No.
Oh, my God. Michael Salih, where have you been?
Yeah, tell me.
Okay, well, QAnon is, it came out of 4chan. You know this, right? It came out of 4chan. There is supposedly a person or a group of persons who go by the name Q, which is a security level clearance. And they are letting the people know that Donald Trump is aligned with certain forces in the government who are fighting the deep state, including
uh-huh. Oh, yeah,
with
yeah,
Mueller.
Yeah, okay.
Mueller's actually on Trump's side.
Yes.
And there's a great awakening that's happening. And you hear about the great awakening sort of like, I think it's transmogrified into like, the great leaving of people leaving Democrats. And, you know, it reaches Dave Rubin in some type of diluted form, I think.
Right.
And there's going to be a, I can't remember if it's like a tidal wave or some, whatever the term is. I mean, this is, but listen to some of the Trump supporters out in line as interviewed by CNN last night.
Are you holding a big red, white, and blue Q? Why do you have that?
It's a movement, man. It's the shift. I can feel it coming. Some call it the Great Awakening.
You're wearing a shirt that says QWWG1WGA. What does that mean?
It means where we go one, we go all.
QAnon is the people that believe in what Trump's trying to do to change our country.
That is a generalization. More specifically, what QAnon is a fringe movement in which many baseless conspiracy theories are discussed on the Internet, organized around the idea of an anonymous but well-connected person or persons nicknamed Q. Your shirt says, the storm is here, QAnon. What does that mean to you?
Well, I've been following all the posts since October 28th.
On the Internet, from QAnon.
Right, started on 4chan.
The person or people who say they're Q.
Right.
What do you think Q is, by the way?
It's an entity of 10 or less people
on top of the government?
High clearance, you know, security clearance.
And how do you know that?
Well, I'm just telling you, this is what it appears to be.
What it appears to be. So you don't have any proof of that. That's what you're guessing it is.
And you don't have any proof there, is it?
We've all been gathering online and talking together as Americans and uniting. And
you think it's maybe just it makes you comfortable talking with other frustrated, sometimes
yes,
angry people?
Yes.
But maybe it's not true because there's no evidence of it. It's just stuff being talked about on the Internet, right?
There hasn't been any non-evidence yet.
They're all screaming at Jim Acosta. What about that guy?
Right. There's no non-evidence.
That is the cult. I mean, that is it right there, right? We talk about Trump as a cult, and there it is right there.
Yeah.
QAnon, I mean, that was generous for what they're, like, no one there went into what they actually talk about on Twitter, which is, you know, like, deeply anti-Semitic stuff that is this globalist conspiracy that is going to lead to a permanent takeover of the government by Donald Trump,
right,
with thousands of secret indictments that are all going to roll out any minute now. And the Mueller thing is just this, like, this head fake to make it happen. I mean, it is deeply conspiratorial in the grossest, and it's not new is what I'm saying. This is an old conspiracy just with a new name.
Well,
and the internet.
What do they say about Kushner in that?
What do they say about Kushner?
Yeah,
what do they say about Kushner?
Yeah.
I don't know. They have a, it's like also as dumb as the internet. You know, it's like a YouTube comments come to life sort of
right.
thing. So like they put up weird pictures, the Q, the supposed Q guy, puts up like weird pictures of just a street, and then it says, look closer. And then like hundreds of people start putting and projecting what they believe
okay.
onto it.
And there's also, my understanding is that Q went away for a while, and then R showed up. This is not, I'm not joking. And there, and they, you know, for a while it was being pushed by Alex Jones and Jerome Corsi of Swift Boat fame, but then they got off the Q train and they got pushed. There's two questions that I have for both you guys. One is, what is the likelihood this is just some dude on 4chan going like, I want to see if I could do this, right? Just like, I'm going to make this up and see who buys into it. Like, oh, dude, look what I did. I said, look at this picture. And it got 5,000 hits. And people are just, like, coming up with theories. Like, that's what it is, right? It's just somebody fucking with them.
I think it
could be, but I it sounds to me more like true believers. Do you think the person started this as a true believer? Like, it has to start with somebody.
Although they could be the, like, 4chan, like, white nationalist right-wing
right.
trolls. They're kind of true believers in their own way. They're, right, like, he might not or she might not believe it, but they also understand what they're unleashing with
right.
this, like,
they can do with it.
An ultimate right. troll or something, right? Like, and they're, it's this whole thing where they're taking on the mainstream media with this trolling, and it is a big joke, but it has a purpose. It has a deeply partisan and ideological purpose. It's very Bannon-esque, right?
That's
and
right.
You see Bannon do this stuff.
That's right. The breakup of Ivanka and Jared.
Okay. So, all right, let me ask you this question then. Have you ever seen a conspiracy that is like this, that is on the side of power? Like even when the even during the Bush years, we had people who would write and go like Gannon Guckert. You remember that dude?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so I should just tell people who don't know, there was a guy in the press pool that was being called on by, I can't remember the guy's name. He was sort of like a, he was the first Bush spokesperson.
Yeah, and there were
sort of like
a lot
pudgy,
of rumors
pudgy
about him and Gannon,
right.
too.
So they keep calling yeah. this guy from some like random website. And at that time, websites were not that big of a deal, but this was like a totally random one. And then someone realized like, hey, wait, this guy's was like on escort listing services
That's right.
In military fatigues. And
with a different name.
With a different
and
name.
And now he's got, and he was getting a day pass to the White House every day. He wasn't even getting credentials. He wasn't credentialed generally. He was literally having to be okayed every single day.
And so there was some, and then it became like, oh, Guckert Gannon's part of a pedophile ring or something. Like he'd been kidnapped and held in the White House by the Bushes for generations or something. But okay, you always have fringe people who try and explain something that might be just like, somebody could be having a relationship with this guy, and part of the compensation is like, I'll help your website. You can be a reporter now.
Right.
But this is, they're in power. Like, they're creating, like, an Ubermensch story about the president as if he need, like, that to me is strange. That part. That Trump's in power, and yet there's still a conspiracy around his being in power.
Right.
As opposed to being on the weak side, where you need this type of
thing. I have a, like, you take the conversation where you want to go, but you have seen this before. We have seen this before. You just have to go really a ways back. But if you look before World War One, when you had the four dynasties, you had Tsarist Russia, and you had secret police force who were actively pushing giant conspiracies that literally led to a conflagration that destroyed all four of those same dynasties that were pushing this stuff. They wielded conspiracies while in power. And the thing that was so dangerous then is that you had the government was actually instrumental in pushing this stuff. They might not have started it, but once they saw the power it had to whip up, especially hatred of, Russia had to hate Germany. Germany had to hate Russia and France. And so all these stories and conspiracies at that time were wielded by power. And so it hasn't happened recently, and it's like mockable, but you have read about this, or I've read about this, and it's actually scary.
And it works.
It's a scary phenomenon.
It works for them. It works. They have a base that is conspiratorial. That is what drives them, right? That is what moves them.
And the first thing is, if you disconnect from the truth, right? So don't believe your eyes. And he literally said that.
That's right.
Don't believe your eyes.
What you're seeing is not happening.
It's not happening. Only believe me. And then they create a story that's so ridiculous that you're like, who would believe that? But that's kind of the point. It softens up the turf. It makes less things that are actually also ridiculous, but they're less ridiculous than that.
Right.
Seem more credible. Right. Like that untethering from the truth. Climate change is not real. Big business has put a ton of money behind this as well. I just think you're seeing it accelerating, and maybe Frankenstein monster-esque. It's out of the creator's control.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Alex, let me say goodbye to you. Let Michael sit into the
good to see you, Alex.
To the hot seat, as it were, and get rid of Scott's really nasty headphones. I can't believe.
No, I feel like I'm sorry. I had a
Jay from.
I'm sorry, my ears had to be in here.
Jay from Connecticut is now going to be. I'm never going to hear the end of that. Let me just. All right, so Michael.
Yes.
Well, here's a proper welcome to the show. Now we have you on camera. All right. Let me ask you this in the context of that last conversation as we go into some other topics. One of the things that I miss about doing radio, I mean, obviously this is live. We get phone calls from folks on YouTube and listening to the stream, but and to a certain extent, you don't have the same dynamic that you have in AM radio on Sirius, but there's some of that where somebody's just going to spin the dial on Sirius and like, oh, listen to this guy talking and like, what? I'm curious, what do you hear from? Because when I get a call from like a conservative now, they're basically just trying to explain to me how race theory or IQ theory justifies racism, or it's somebody who wants to defend Jordan Peterson or something that are like sort of, that to me feel like maybe they're marginal and a little bit more YouTube-ish in terms of what are there mainstream conservatives anymore? Do they call in and say like, do they ever, is all they talking about is PC is a problem? Or do they ever talk about we need to have blank policy? Like, have you ever heard, like, is there, you ever get any conservative callers who have like a problem with like a policy issue?
It's changed since the beginning of Trump's presidency. I mean, there was a more kind of diverse, for lack of a better word, range of Trump supporters who would call. And I think a lot of people got, at least if they didn't get off the train, they weren't going to call a radio show and say they were still on it.
They weren't broadcasting the fact that they
were
still on.
But we still get some people who don't believe or don't support a lot of things that he says and does, but they think the economy's great. They think the, you know, tax bill was great. They think they do argue those policies. And then you, of course, argue with them about, but even if that were true, which it's not, what about what he said about this, or what about this racist attack or that racist attack? And it just comes down to what their priorities are. So there's still that group of people.
All right, I haven't heard anybody calling. I mean, I could see, like, look, the economy is the trajectory has been maintained.
I call it the Obama economy that he's destroying.
I mean, and we're starting to see, you know, wage stagnation. The job numbers may get hurt by this. Income inequality, which Obama didn't particularly address is not being addressed in this administration. But to say that he hasn't ruined the economy yet is factually true. So at least there's some tethering to that. And I suppose if I was, I was a CEO of a decent-sized corporation, I'd be pretty happy with the tax cut. So I could see that at least that's exactly in some way comforting to me, that there's at least some people out there trying to make some type of rational
argument
about it.
Well, I don't know if you saw this Hugh Hewitt column in the Washington Post the other day.
As soon
it was
as you
so
said
bizarre.
Hugh Hewitt, I would have said no. But but I'm open to hearing about it.
Well, it was this sort of mentality. It was like he was trying to do a sort of rebuttal to George Will, saying, vote for Democrats this year. And his was, vote for Republicans. And he was basically saying, you might not like this, and you might not like that, and you might not like this, but look at how great the economy is right now. Look at how we're building, you know, on things that we, you know, we're trying to do in terms of battling, forces around the world like North Korea. Look, I mean, he's trying to take everything and say, you know, here's an argument for why you should, and that if you, and he was trying to put it in terms of stability, keep things stable. This was such a complete turnaround, because if we elect Democrats, there will be chaos. Donald Trump will be impeached. There will be chaos in the country.
He's right.
But right now, it's a stability.
Right.
Now that's a really crazy
idea.
That's
a tough argument. I mean, I think you could say, like, it's going to get a little bit crazier if you elect Democrats. And I think it is. I mean, I think, like, because we're going to start to actually see more about what's going on with the Trump administration, and we're going to see genuine obstruction, I hope. I don't know why Hugh Hewitt doesn't just say, like, you got to vote Republican because we're getting the biggest, widest swath of regressive judges that we've had in generations.
Yeah, well, I mean, he brought up the judges. He brought up Kavanaugh, all of that, you know, so
we're going to be able to gut all the regulatory agencies. We're going to unleash you might phrase it differently than me, but the worst inclinations of business, and they're going to be able to, we're going to take us back to the 20s. It's going to be the roaring 20s again.
Yeah.
So what else? I mean, what else is capturing the imagination of your audience these days in terms of what you discussed?
Well, you know, it's interesting what you mentioned about the conservatives who call. I do have an odd sort of regular people.
Jay from Connecticut.
And then there are the people who, no, I mean conservative.
Okay.
And then there are the people who are just, you know, going down the dial and, you know, come upon you, and they probably listen to Hannity and they just switch it out. And it's really like they landed on another planet. And those are the ones you realize that they're in a total bubble. And, you know, don't get. But it is interesting. We have those people. I like to engage them because I know a lot of my other listeners, that's their family, that's their cousin, that's their uncle. They want to know how to challenge them. I try to do my best to you know, give an example. But our larger audience, it's just, it's women, people of color, LGBT people, really energized. The Women's March was like unbelievable when we did nonstop, you know, coverage all day because covering the marches all across the country.
Uh-huh.
And people were calling all over the country, heading to a march, coming from a march, at the march. I mean, that's when we just realized how much, you know, we had so much of the audience that was out there in the mountains, in the desert, everywhere, just, you know, because satellite can get there. And interesting thing, when Robert De Niro did his Fuck Trump, remember that one?
Uh-huh.
And everybody said, oh my God, you know, the crowd that said, oh my God, this is going to hurt.
Right.
I played that and talked about it, and women calling just nonstop. Black women, white women, young women, all of them saying, thank you, Robert De Niro. Thank you, Robert De Niro. Thank you, Robert De Niro. I mean, the energy out there. So when people say things like that are going to dampen our cause, or, you know, this is all just old thinking. I mean, people were exhilarated. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the concern is on some level that it's going to, like, motivate the conservative base, right? Like, that's the big fear. Like, you're going to wake the sleeping tiger or something. But I think their aggrievement, it's just much harder to activate.
And it's going to remind them that Hollywood is evil? Like, what? You know, they've been doing that one forever.
Right. Holly weird. But I think the idea is that, yeah, it's supposed to, like, motivate these people to vote, to get out and vote and push back on the the Hollywood elite. And I just don't think that sense of aggrievement is going to get activated that easily.
It's not enough for them to run on. Even, you know, this immigration thing, I mean, everything we see, it hasn't worked, right? Everything we see, these attacks on immigrants, they tried it in Virginia. They've tried it in every special election. It doesn't work. You know, MS-13, most people have no experience with a gang.
Right.
They have no idea what it is. The separating of children at the border has horrified people. And yet, it's all they have. So they're going to run that and Hollywood elite, and, you know, they don't have much.
No,
and the tax bill isn't working.
They don't have much, but they may not need much, Michael, as you know, because when the Great Awakening happens and Mueller comes out with a long list of indictments, including the Obamas, the Clintons, probably Mayor Bloomberg, who else... The list is going to be long, and I'm not convinced that you will not be on it. All right, well, listen.
I'm sure you're going to be on it.
I hope so. I appreciate your coming by. I want to play that, Michael Signorelli. Folks, do you have a website? Like, how do people, like, access your show if you don't have Sirius? If you have Sirius, you should go to 127.
Yeah. They can go to SiriusXM.com and get a trial subscription, or they can go to my website, Signorelli.com, SignorElli.com.
Screw those guys. Screw Sirius. Have them go to your website. You can filter them in from there. All right. Well, thank you so much,
thank
Mike.
You.
I appreciate it. All right. I want to play this clip of Deb Haaland, who is running for Congress in New Mexico's 1st District. And then we'll have Dino Badala will join us in just a moment. All right. So, Matt, are you good to run that?
Yep.
All right, so we're going to run that clip interview that took place just an hour ago. Okay. So sitting with me now, Netroots Nation 2018, she is running for Congress in New Mexico's 1st District, Deb Haaland. She would be, my understanding is you would be the first Native American woman elected to the House of Representatives.
Yes.
And, all right, so that's
240 years.
I mean, we're almost ready.
Hey, exactly. It's only taken, you know, a quarter of a century, but that's okay.
But let's back up a little bit. Give me a sense of what you've been doing in politics through your life and how
we
got to this point.
Sure. Well, you know, I probably got involved close, verging on 20 years ago, just started out as a phone volunteer because I felt like I wanted, you know, I wanted candidates who cared about Indian issues to get elected. And so I would go into campaign offices, ask for lists of Native Americans, and make phone calls. I just felt that in New Mexico, we're about 10% of the population, actually over right now, over 10%. And I just felt that we could have an effect on getting folks who cared about our issues elected. So that turned into me showing up, actually organizing in Indian Country. And so I got paid for a few elections as a staffer. And in 2012, I was the state Native American vote director for President Obama's reelection campaign. And so I've been at it for a while.
Was there something about this time that convinced you to run, or is this something that
I never thought of running for Congress. No, absolutely not. In fact, I didn't even think about running for office at all when I first got started. I just did it because I felt I wanted more Indians to vote. But in 2014, I decided to run for lieutenant governor. We were experiencing just kind of some low morale in New Mexico for the Democrats. We had a Republican governor. In fact, she's still there. She's termed out this year. She was terrible, doing terrible things to our state and had a ton of money. And everyone just were bracing themselves for her reelection in 2014. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to run because I felt like I might be able to energize some folks. And we lost in the general. And then I decided to, and we lost our state house that year also. And so that's what influenced me to run for state party chair. And I won that election in 2015. And then we won everything back in 2016. We had a great year for Democrats in New Mexico in 2016. And so this year we'll get a Democratic governor. We'll keep this seat a blue seat because it is now. And hopefully flip the southern district in New Mexico to blue as well.
So, all right, give me a sense of what the top issues are. I mean, a lot of we hear is, if I'm to believe what we hear coming out of Washington, whatnot, all you're talking about is Donald Trump. Is that the case?
No. In fact, I try to talk about him as little as possible.
I understand.
I mean,
believe
people
me.
Know. You know, they want to know that you're going to put up a fight, and
right.
Yes, so I will do that. But there are a lot of pressing issues. One of those is climate change and renewable energy, and that was actually the number one issue in my primary election campaign. We talked a tremendous amount about that. Currently in New Mexico, in my district, there are a tremendous number of people who care about immigration because the latest immigration policies coming out of Washington, D.C. and out of the White House are appalling. They're racist. It's terrible. We care about that in New Mexico. And so that's another big issue. And, of course, with this Supreme Court nominee, you know, hanging over everyone's head, there's a tremendous amount of concern about women's reproductive rights. I've been on the front lines fighting for that as well for a long, long time. But, you know, everything, education, veterans, I mean, it's all important, and we're talking about all of those things.
I'm hearing too that a lot of candidates are saying the healthcare is a big issue.
Indeed, yes.
And where are you on that?
Medicare for all. I mean, everybody needs healthcare. Everybody needs to be able to go to the doctor when they're sick. Everybody should be able to get birth control pills prescribed, you know, by any insurance company. I am definitely, I would never ever vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act until there's absolutely something to replace it, like Medicare for All.
What does Medicare for All mean to you? I mean,
it certainly means that every single person will have the opportunity for health care. And in my state, just to give you an example of the size and sort of poverty issues that we face in New Mexico, half of our population is Medicaid eligible. So there aren't enough jobs. They're not paying enough. People need some relief.
And so wait, when we say Medicare for All, everybody has health insurance. Does that mean we have basically the same parameters of Medicare as it exists today for people over the age of 65 and we expand that? Or what? Are there specific bills that you'll support that you know are out there?
Right. I mean, I'm not in Congress yet, but you probably know that Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal just started a Medicare for All caucus. So I would like to join that caucus. I would like to work on a plan to make sure that whatever we do is viable for people across the country.
And one of the themes that has been cropping up is the relationship between local politicians, people running in the district, and the DCCC, mm-hmm. the DNC. There's mm-hmm. been a lot of stories about this that cut across both ideological lines. But what has been your experience? I mean, you were already sort of part of the Democratic, I don't want to say establishment, but part of the Democratic machine in your state. So this as much of an issue for you?
Well, as state party chair, of course, you have to work with the DNC.
Right.
And the DNC actually gives states money every month to help with the party. So the money that the DNC gave us, for example, we were able to hire a voter file manager and pay for some other things. So, I mean,
this wasn't as much of an issue for you as it might have been for other candidates?
I mean, I think they give money to every state. So, look, I'm a team player. I want us to win back the House in November.
Me too.
I will work with the DNC. I'll work with the DCCC. I'll work with the folks on the ground. I'll work with the county parties. Whatever we have to do to make sure that we win back the House, that's what I will do. Something I'm especially happy about this year is that the DNC actually gave out money to various, I'm not sure if it's every state, but they gave it to our state to help us get out the Native American vote. It's 10.5% of our population in New Mexico. There are rural communities all over New Mexico. They gave the state party money for that purpose. I'm extremely happy about that. That's what I've been working on for a long time. That's where my passion lies. So I think that the DNC is working hard to engage people across the spectrum. So I'm happy about that. I think rural communities really need our attention, and so that's a good thing.
Give me a sense of the sort of the unique issues of Indian folk in this country, because they're, you know, it seems to me that there is an awakening of sorts that's taking place maybe in the context of Trump, but I think before that with Black Lives Matter and this, the notion of intersectionality has become, I think widely adopted and at least in some form or another. On the left, I think there's a broader understanding that a different understanding of what is so-called identity politics and the importance of, mm-hmm. of specific concerns of specific groups being addressed and then almost like communitarianized, I guess, if you will. But give me the perspective that you have on politics in terms of Indian people, because we don't, Native Americans seem to be sidelined in many respects of these conversations.
Right, yeah, they haven't been invited to a seat at the table in many respects. And so having a seat at the table, having a voice in the halls of Congress, I think it definitely will be new.
Right.
And But I hope to, I mean, I will absolutely bring my background, my history, my perspective to the table. I think that, you know, I went to Standing Rock in 2016. I took some New Mexico green chili with me. I cooked on the campfire at Chairman Archambault's camp, shared our New Mexico food with the people there. I feel like that sustained protest to protect our environment was something that helped a lot of people sort of understand what it is that we truly care about. And certainly if we don't have our environment, we don't have anything. It's very plain to see. So I really hope that perhaps what I can do is help other people to realize how important the Native American voice is in our politics and moving forward. Because, look, we have a torturous history in this country. And when you think about the Trump administration separating families at the border, that happened to us during the boarding school era. Right. My grandmother was separated from her family for 5 years when she was 8 years old. Those are, you know, those that history, it's eerily similar to what's happening now. And so we know about genocide. We know about family separation. We know about our land being taken. We know about these things. So our voice can be extremely important to the progressive movement. And I think that I would like to see us have more of an opportunity to speak at the table.
Do you think that there's something, I mean, the idea that in the American psyche, the ability to ignore that history, that recent history even, of what we've done to Native people in this country is like some type of, I mean, I don't want to over psychological, you know, make it too psychological, but it's almost as if we cannot deal with that original sin of the founding of this country. And so anything subsequent has to also be completely expunged from our national consciousness.
Yeah, that's, you know, and I want to keep that memory alive. We can't ever forget those things. And the sad fact of it is that there are a lot of people in this country who don't even know about our history of this country. And the only way I think you can truly understand sort of where we are now is by learning about the history of our country. There have been so many things that have happened. You know, I just finished reading this book called Killers of the Flower Moon. It's about the Osage murders. And Osage tribe in Oklahoma, when they struck oil on their land after they had been pushed onto this reservation land, people started dying because they were being killed so that folks could come in and take over their head rights for... and it was all about money, right?
Right.
So, I mean, there's been fights over oil. There's been fight. You know, it's so ingrained in our history. And if you don't, I think the way to move forward is definitely to make sure that we understand and know the fights that we've had in the past, so that we can arm ourselves and make it better.
Deb Holland, hopefully we'll see you in Congress by this time next year.
Absolutely.
Good luck.
Thanks so much.
Where can folks go to learn more about your candidacy?
Thank you. DebForCongress.com, DebForCongress.com. You can find us on Twitter at DEB, the number for Congress. And, of course, we're on Facebook, Deb Holland for Congress.
All right. We will post that in today's show notes, and it'll be on the blog at
majority.fm.
Thank you, Deb. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're back live from Netroots Nation 2018. We're in the airport hangar. There was some brief excitement that Senator Cory Booker was walking around. I just couldn't get that excited. But with me is someone who did, Dino Badala. He is the host of the 6 to 9 p.m. I was basically just a walking advertiser for Sirius Satellite Radio today. Dean Obadala is on. He's the 6 to 9 p.m. host of the Dean Obadala Show.
I'm on right after Michael Andrew Signorelli, who was literally just on here.
That's
so
right. That's right. It works I'm out doing perfectly. The whole...
So you're not a big, not excited by Senator Booker. The place went crazy.
Who's 9 to noon? Oh, there's Cynthia Nixon. Now, that excites me. Scott, go mention to Cynthia that...
if you get her on her show, great, because I can't get her on my show.
Oh, I'll get her on the show. She'll come and say hi.
Do you know her?
I do know her. I do know her. I mean, just...
All right.
All right. Well, he'll try. Scott's...
I'm watching... It's funny. You're watching your producer. Right now, let's describe the play-by-play action.
Yeah, exactly.
Just Sam's producer got off the chair. He's addressing... He's going up to Nixon. And
so, Dean, this is your first Netroots Nation.
Crazy. It is.
Right? Like, you're just such a newbie, but the funny thing is, like, you and I have been talking for 15 years on the radio,
probably.
I feel like. Right? Pretty close. Maybe 12, 13.
Yeah. Everything starts at 9/11 for me, so I'm going back to think of then. That's what my activism. What happened, Scott? Is she going to come on?
And I totally inspired you to go into radio. Was
you did.
Right?
It was all Sam. I went on Sam and Janine's show on Air America, and I'm like, if this guy could do this, I mean, just think what I could do with my skill set. No, I
exactly.
just enjoyed, and then going on Mark Maron's show a lot, then going on you and Mark Maron's show in the break room. But as a comedian, when I was much more of a touring comedian with tours, going on radio was a part of what we did to promote our shows. So radio wasn't foreign. Hosting was unique. But going on radio and understanding the power of radio, reaching people in their cars and their houses, and then seeing the action, and that time the call to action was buy tickets to a show, and seeing that actually happen, I started to realize the power of radio. So coming from that comedy world to here, I actually believe that radio can reach people. It can make you buy tickets. It can inspire you. Now it's just trying to inspire them to be active on issues and engage on issues. So just a little different call to action. It's not different than the idea of using radio. It's a great medium.
And my favorite part about that is that you now have the... I wish I had some type of name for this. But the sort of like the left-wing radio host lament, which is like, why on the right do they understand the power of radio? But on the left, it's like the ugly stepchild, right? Like, I mean, I've had this conversation with a bunch of people,
sure.
even just the past couple of days. Like, the Nation magazine's not writing. I mean, I'm not. You know, look, I don't need the publicity. I had a good round of it in December, and I'm willing to. But on the right, there's a whole infrastructure that promotes. You know, the communications part of their machine. And on the left, there's none of that. Absolutely none of that.
I wonder, my question, and I bet you've thought this through and have an answer, frankly, on the right, and I don't say this in any way to be, like, condescending, we're wired differently. And people on the right, from what I've heard...
You can be condescending.
I will be often. But in this case, I'm actually trying to be more objective about to try to get to the truth of this. Is that when I listen to talk radio, and again, when I was traveling around before doing radio, and in my car, renting cars and going to speak at colleges in the Midwest and stuff, I would go to talk radio, and I would like to listen to conservative sometimes just to hear, and I would change the channel, and another conservative talk radio were doing the exact same thing. These weren't national. And I got the sense conservatives like to hear the same thing. They like to hear the same thing told to them over and over that they're a victim, whatever it might be. Forget the message. They want to be told the same thing and told they're right and the other side is wrong over and over and over. Well, I don't find on the left we want that. When you see, I think progressives want to learn. I think they want to be challenged sometimes, but I think they want to learn. And if you're just going to go on and say the same thing over and over like they do on the right, maybe it doesn't attract people on the left. And I'm honestly just trying to come to terms with it. I thought this through. I'm like, maybe that's it? Or is it if you had more high level and I had more high level progressive activists on and celebrities who are on the left, even elected officials, would we have more people tuning in? I don't know.
I can tell you that Air America's ratings were good.
Right.
We had good ratings. I mean, Janine and I would beat Levin and Laura Ingraham, I think it was at that time. And, you know, we, at first we were, I think, around 7 to 10, so we were across two different day parts. But we had good ratings. You know, I'm thinking of New York. I you know, maybe in Portland and L.A., maybe not so good. And but we weren't on for that long, I think, in L.A. We lost the affiliate because the bills weren't paid. The problem was is that we had poor management. And we also, they didn't understand what was coming in terms of the internet and podcasts, which was obvious.
Right.
I'll say it's obvious, but it was pretty clear. And, like, you didn't need to have too much imagination to see where this is going. I mean, I had set up before YouTube. You know, there was no YouTube in 2004 when we launched.
There was no Facebook.
There was no Facebook. There was definitely no social media. But within a year or two, I had a video cam that I would actually do an alternate show during the commercial breaks.
You did?
Yes, on the Sammy cam.
That's genius.
And I would...
Stealing that. Note to self.
Well,
steal Sammy
cam.
Yeah,
you could do that. You could do that. I mean, I don't have
breaks. We do Facebook Live on my monologue now, so it gets beyond just the world of Sirius XM. Because we're all trying to get it out there to more people.
But, I mean, this was, you know, 12 years. That could have been... You could have... That's your membership privileges. You know, like, they just didn't think about it in that those terms. So the management wasn't there. But I do think that it's a different market, and that was part of the problem, too, is that, like, you could bring people in who worked in right-wing talk radio. They just don't know what to do with it. They don't know where, like, the strength lies. They don't understand the depth of that the audience has in terms of relationship. I mean, it's a totally different ballgame. But
what about the support? Do you think it would be different? Let's flash forward to today. Do you think progressive talk radio would be different and competing more with conservative talk radio if we had the support of the infrastructure of the Democrat, not the progressive people? Activists want to come on our shows all the time, but I'm talking about the high-level politicians. They all go on Hannity and Rush and all that stuff.
Well, and they didn't initially.
Wait, I'm asking, so the bottom, is it a chicken and egg thing? Like, they go on now because the reach is great, but do they go on up-and-coming conservative talk?
I don't think that's the reason. I think I think money is afraid to get involved in it because of Air America, and I think there's also, there's a different sort of structure of, you know, value on the left, and so like the Nation magazine, the editors will not okay a story on like a liberal YouTube sensation. Like, I mean, look, regardless of where you think about TYT politics or whatnot, I mean, because I know that there's like, you know, depending on what section of the Democratic Party you're from, there's some antagonism or whatnot. But regardless of what you think of their politics, they are clearly of the left. And they are clearly the biggest news channel on YouTube. Like, how is there not multiple features in, like, In These Times,
idea.
Mother Jones, Nation right. Magazine, American Prospect? You know, they won't go because it's sort of, there is on the left just a sort of a looking and a devaluing of that stuff, which I understand from an academic standpoint, but they don't seem to appreciate the value of it from a communication standpoint. I mean, that's what is basically going on there.
It's interesting. It's not something I thought about, the lack of coverage of the success of certain progressive.
How could you not cover that? How could that not be a story? Right? I mean, how could it not be? I mean, just on a sheer dollar amount.
But what about the mainstream, the media outside of that? What about the New York Times? Have they been covered by...
There may have been a small story, but you don't get, like, a profile of Cenk like you would Ben Shapiro, right? Like,
oh, that's a great point. No, you're absolutely right.
Anybody talking about Cenk Uygur as the, you know, the left's philosophical king or whatnot. I mean, you know, Ben Shapiro is not a... an intellectual titan. I hate to break it to people, right?
He's an idiot. I mean, I have to be honest. I dealt with Ben Shapiro. We've all dealt with Ben Shapiro. I dealt with Ben Shapiro before he was known as Ben Shapiro, when he was just like Ben Shapiro.
Well,
just a guy.
That's because you are a dirty Muslim.
And a Palestinian heritage, that's the bigger part.
Wait, no, you're not Muslim, right?
I am.
Oh, you are Muslim.
My mom's Catholic. I was raised with both faiths.
Okay.
But I
So you're just dirty Muslim enough.
To have Ben, but being a Palestinian heritage, I think, is more concerning to Ben than being Muslim, because
would he get physically intimidated by you because of your Palestinian heritage?
I've never met Ben in person. We used to have some fights on Twitter and stuff, and then he got a ton of followers, And then he doesn't respond. But we would have little battles here and there. And I don't battle as much on Twitter, to be honest, because I've learned it's a losing proposition.
Right.
I'm only going to get fired from it because I'm going to say something stupid in the height.
Oh, right. Now you can get fired. Yeah.
Easily fired.
You know, now I'm completely inoculated from being fired.
Because you hire yourself.
No. Well, because I work for myself and I got hired and fired by MSNBC. Because.
But you're back.
But I'm back. So now I'm inoculated.
You can do anything you want.
Now I can do whatever I want because because it's like getting I've built up an immunity to Twitter firings. Once you get fired once and then you get bring back, you build up like an immunity. You can't get Twitter fired again.
Well, I watch you on MSNBC a lot because my show is 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. And all the channels are on MSNBC and Fox News. And in closed caption, you make a lot of sense. Because
the volume
is off. But I'm reading it like, that's Sam. Look at Sam. Even closed caption is making sense. And other people, I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. Because it's all jumbled because it's closed caption. But you speak in a cadence that they can translate quickly.
I give the closed caption people, with every time I do an I do a lot of uhs when I speak. And so when I do that, that's when they know they can catch up on their typing.
That's pretty good. So it works out well.
Yes.
But I don't listen to anything. I saw Ari Melbourne, and I said, hey, I watch your show every night with the sound off, and it didn't come off. It didn't come out the right way. And he goes, what? I'm like, all right, it's too long to explain, but I read your
never
show.
Mind.
I'm like, I read your
yeah,
show.
Yeah, never mind. Sorry about that. All right, well, so give me your impression of, this is your first Netroots.
First Netroots.
What's your impression of it? Because, I come here and I see it through the eyes of someone who's been to a bunch of these. So
it's jaded and broken.
Jaded, broken,
fired and rehired.
Sad,
a guy
old.
Seen it all.
Yes, all right. Of it.
I have never been here before. I have to be honest. I think I expected more a mass of people, like when I watch clips of CPAC and stuff. But the reality was, it was because during the day when I walked in here, it was very diffuse. There's so many events going on. When I went to the keynote last night and there were thousands of people in that room, I'm like, everyone is here. They just really are going to different panels. So I went to some panels that were attended by 15 people. Like, what do you mean thousands of people? Like, what is this live thousands of people? Fake news, right? And then I go last night, and there were thousands of people here. And the energy in the room, and right now Cory Booker speaking with Mustafa Santiago Ali, my friend, is introducing him and stuff. And you can hear some of the crowd. So
yeah.
The energy is here, and the people are here. And I'm really happy about that because I was more like, this is such an important year. Where's everyone? If you're not excited this year, it's a progressive. What the hell's going on?
It is one of the things I've noticed about these things is the physical space really does impact the perception of the event. So, I mean, the more almost in some ways condensed it is, the more energy it feels like.
Right, exactly. We were on top of each other. Like, oh, my God, I can't go to the bathroom.
Teeming,
this place
right?
is crazy.
Exactly. But this thing is so massive. I mean, this exhibition hall is huge.
Do you use the gender-specific bathroom or the gender-neutral bathroom? Because they have two choices here.
I use the gender-neutral bathroom just because I couldn't find the gender-specific bathroom.
Oh, it's down there. I didn't know I'm allowed to go to... I'm not kidding. I didn't know. Like, I'm not being jerky about this. I'm like, gender-neutral, is that for people who identify as gender or they're transitioning and they're using that? Because I honestly felt like... I don't know if I'm supposed to go in there. So I looked around for the men's room and I found it on the other side of the hall.
Yeah. I mean, there are bathrooms here that say gender neutral, right?
Right.
And I presume that's not a function. I mean, I thought like, oh, that's...
For anybody.
No, that was my two sides.
Well, I'm like, is that for anybody?
No, the first thing I thought was like, is this a mandate from Netroots? But the signs seem to be there. Like they...
I don't think they put it up for this event. I think that's really...
Which I think
hall,
is pretty
like,
good.
Right.
And maybe there's a backstory to that because I've never seen that in any other.
I created a Muslim-only bathroom on the other side of the hall. It says Muslims only. It's kind of freaking people out a bit. But
I have never seen that, and for me, it's not that big of a deal. When I was in college, we had co-ed dorms, and so it was.
You did?
Yeah. So you just go to the bathroom, but there's stalls. You just go in. It's going
very
into the stalls.
With that. I'm uncomfortable with a public bathroom. I want my own bathroom. I don't want Dean, not gender neutral, I want Dean Obidala's bathroom that he can use because he has issues that he has to work out.
I understand.
And that would be so much better.
No, you know, that's fine. I'm glad you're letting everyone know that.
I'm just sharing. I thought this is a kind of radio show where you share your
real... No,
as opposed to my show, I keep it all in. No one knows this. But I share everything. I can't help it. From the world of comedy where you translate your struggles, your neurosis into stand-up comedy. Here I just talk about on the radio... In between having guests on.
No, of course. No, I understand. I mean, so That's why you always look so uncomfortable when I see you in public. Because you've not, you've not been able to find a bathroom.
I have not been able to find a bathroom for hours.
I actually did a pilot of a show about two beat cops, or two cops who were working in the precinct, and they get thrown onto the street, and one of them can only go to bathrooms that he's been to before.
That's
so
pretty
he's got
fair.
A, he's got
that's
a big, big problem.
Story. You stole my life story. This is ridiculous.
There you go.
I'm going to have to talk to my lawyer
about
this.
All right, so what do you think about, like, give me a sense of, so you've seen the big crowds. What do you, give me a sense of what you think in terms of, like, the diversity.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because, to me, I look around and, look, first, America's the majority of white people. So, but you come to the progressive movement and you're like, well, it's probably going to be minority-majority here. It's not. It's overwhelmingly younger white people. But at the same time, I'm told it's the most diverse it's ever been. I'm like, what was going on before this?
Yeah.
And this time, this year, there are two or three panels of Muslim Americans, young Muslim Americans who I know from political activism. I'm like, have you ever been here? They go, no, never been here. They were never invited. They were never invited to be. They could have come. Don't get me wrong. There was no discrimination. I'm not saying that.
Right, right.
But when you give people a panel that's about anti-Muslim bigotry in the time of politics and time of Trump, you're making it a specific invite. You're putting people on the panel, and then they're telling their friends, and others come here and say, hey, this is great. So there were two panels on
You're making it relevant. You're broadening the relevance right. to people, too. I mean, that's...
It's a good point. You're saying you're inclusive into this world. I interviewed a disability activist yesterday who is the next level of challenges. I thought she was going to come on my show, she's a professor, to talk about progressives getting involved and fighting for policies to ensure the disabled are getting the funding they need. No, she was here to talk about the lack of disabled people in the progressive community telling their own stories and being on panels and having things to accommodate them. And she brought up this idea of you don't have a silent room here. And I go, what's that for? She goes, people with autism, sensory overload, they want a room that they can recharge and reset and be inside. I'm like, wow, I never even thought about that. So what I like is that progressives, when we're our blind spots are called out, I don't get defensive. I mean, I don't run this thing, but I'm not defensive. I'm more intrigued. I'm like, that's a great point. And you can see the next group of people who are like, we want to be at the table, and we want to tell our story. Even there might be well-intentioned advocates and allies out here on the disability community. Same thing for Muslims. There were so many advocates who are not Muslim who are great activists and allies. We're ready to tell our story now. We have people who are doctors and lawyers and engineers and running for office. Things have changed. The disabled community is saying the same thing. They want that next. That was really very eye-opening for me. And I love learning. As a progressive, I'm sincere. I'm like, wow, a light bulb went off. I'm like, I didn't know you were here to talk about that. Like, I mean, I heard a bio. I thought you were here to talk about we have to be fighting more for funding for disabled community. It wasn't that. Disabled community wants to tell their story. I'm like, you're right. Of course you should be.
Right.
It was remarkable.
And I mean, I think there's a there's been a level of sophistication about the way that people will integrate those narratives into the progressive movement and almost, you know, heal thyself on some level and then go out and, you know, it's much easier to advocate if you really understand what you're talking about. Like,
certainly.
You know, as an entity. And, you know, the thing I noticed and was the representation of Palestinian rights here.
Uh-oh.
One is really
Ben
just,
Shapiro's going to shut this down. That's the end of it.
But it's interesting to see, like, what is being, because this is now, I don't want to say that it was co-opted, but it's more professionalized in
That's
some
what I've
respects
heard too.
Than it was, like, you know, 10 years ago. And we were saying that even 4 or 5 years ago. But at the same time, it's also been broadly much more inclusive. And there's just much more attempts to do so. So that's it's interesting to see the developments.
Well, you know, and I'm someone of a Palestinian heritage, and you know, my family lives in the West Bank. I'm happy to see the Palestinian group here. I would have no problem if there was a group here who were advocates. If they were right-wing Netanyahu type, it would be more problematic.
Well,
for,
yes,
for politically.
Because it's a
but
left-wing,
if they were like
right.
J Street or a political group that's about a two-state solution and talk about peace and advocating for security for Israelis, but at the same time advocating for justice for the Palestinians, I'd be like, this is great. You should have all voices. It's the progressive mosaic is the fabric of it's just broader and broader, and that's what's really good about who we are.
You don't. I mean, are you still? I mean, do you still think that a two-state solution is possible?
I think it depends how you define a two-state solution, frankly. I mean, I think if you're going to define it as little unconnected lands of Palestinian territory with some kind of autonomy, as opposed to a contiguous place, you could make that argument. Unless the only way would be actually getting rid of settlements that are not trailer parks, settlements that are actually massive condo developments and homes and stuff. And I don't know how you do it. So I'm at a loss. I used to be such a two-state person. I want peace. I don't know if one state's the answer. I don't know if a federation's the answer. I don't know what the answer is now any longer. Because the number of settlements that have been built over the last, under Netanyahu, is off the charts. And he effectively has made a true two-state solution
impossible.
I'd have to say impossible. Without doing really dismantling settlements, or the Palestinians just accepting little Batistans, like little teeny pieces of land unconnected, where you have Ramallah as the capital, but you can't go to other parts of your own little new country on a straight line, or maybe a little road. But
when was the last time you there? I know you traveled.
Like 10 years. Like, I've been to. No, I mean, 8 or 9 years ago, I was in Haifa because my fiance, we've been engaged forever. Is from Haifa. She's Israeli citizen, but she's Palestinian. Ethnically.
And you've been engaged for
a long time.
Really?
Yeah. She's my fiance forever, as I like to call her. We're getting married. There's a term Muslims use, inshallah, God willing. So, God willing, we're going to get very happy. We live together. She's an actress. She's crazy.
You don't
So, I mean that in the best of ways. Like, to her, getting married means.
Of course, the best ways. Yes.
No. She's great. I'm very happy with her. But
I'm sure she's glad to hear that.
Just share, because she listens to your show every day. And if you're listening, Sam's a great guy, and I'm glad I get to be on. No, but to her, marriage means being older, and she's an actress, and all this stuff. So there's other issues she has about that. I'm like, I don't care. We're happy. We live together. I can have 4 wives. I mean, let's be honest. So I get married once, 3 other slots are open. It's not a big deal to me. I'm like, babe, come on. No, I don't say that. Come on. I'm kidding. I technically, as a Muslim, you can. In reality, you should not. And theologically, you really cannot, because the way the Quran says, you have to be able to treat all the women equally, and not just like buying homes for them. Like, you cannot do that. You really can't. And I don't even know why it's... I know why it's in the Quran, because it was practical at a time of war, but it should have been left there at the time of war, not in today's modern world. That's ridiculous.
Now,
I'm glad that you're out there.
Are you familiar with Sam Harris, by any chance?
Sure, I fought with Sam Harris on CNN, and Sam, his people still every now and then... I'll tell you, in the time... We used to battle a lot on Twitter and stuff, and he wrote in his little... diary, his blog, but I called it a diary and he didn't like that at all. About me. Like, your public diary you wrote about me, Sam. But this was before Trump, honestly. In the time of Trump, my focus is so much on Donald Trump. The Sam Harris's of the world I used to battle with and really passionately battle with mean nothing to me. I don't really care.
It's interesting how the wind has been completely taken out of his sails, though. Because I feel like his audience moved on to something more... just a little bit less cutesy, right? I mean, Sam Harris, I think, is a bigot, but he's a cutesy bigot. And I think his audience was just like, we've graduated. We don't need to be cutesy anymore, right. And you're cutesy. We can just go on to the full-on bigotry. We don't need your fig leaf anymore of atheism or intellectualism or whatever it is, or neuroscience or, you know, transcendental meditation. We don't need that
That's
anymore.
That's a great point.
And he seems to have lost. He also seems to be just sort of less, I don't know. Wrong. Michael follows him quite a bit.
Michelangelo?
No, Michael back in the studio. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
If he's around.
How come I can't hear you guys?
You can't hear me?
Oh, I can hear you now.
Yes.
Would you agree that Sam Harris... Oh, wait, you can't hear. Do you have your headphones?
Oh, he doesn't have headphones.
No, not with me.
Oh, he doesn't have headphones.
Tell Dean that I say hi.
Speak to me in small words.
Michael Brooks says hi.
Hey, how are you, Michael?
He says, how are you?
So, what did you... Yeah, well, I mean, a guy called the show on Wednesday when I was hosting, who said that he knew a woman who went from left to Sam Harris fan, and now she runs a white nationalist page on Facebook.
Making good points?
Okay.
You're nodding.
So, Michael says that a guy called in to the show Wednesday and said she had a friend who went from or he had a friend who she went from left to Sam Harris to running a white nationalist Facebook page.
That's the Underground Railroad of today, of the bigotry. That's where it starts. You dabble in it, exactly. Then you dabble in Harris, and you move on right to white nationalist. No, you know, the thing with Sam, what pissed off Sam is I was on Don Lemon show, this is years ago, and he was giving advice to Muslims, and Don goes, well, what do you think about this advice? And I said, it's like getting advice from Paula Deen about Black Lives Matter. At the time, Paula Deen was on, and he got so mad. I was trying to be like snarky. I wasn't like right. a big boy. And he got so mad. And then he would blah, 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 wrote these things. But look, if you want to, I had no problem with people who want to discuss Islam and the connection to terrorism. And I've never denied the terrorists are Muslim. I've never played that game. Like, these guys, they're Muslim. That's between you and God. Are they doing things consistent with the faith is the really discussion we should be having. Not, are they Muslim? Some Muslims are like, they're not even Muslims. I'm like, that's if you're practicing the faith of Islam, that's between you and God. That's the way I believe, that's the way the faith is. Are they doing things consistent with the teachings of the faith and what we believe in the faith in a mainstream way? That's a discussion we can have. If some extremist wants to believe that the Quran says go kill people, my only hope is to try to, we internally...
Well, look, I mean, the Torah says, talks about stoning.
No, absolutely. If you're not a virgin on your wedding night, bring them before town. And, and that's where stoning's not even in the Quran. But the Islam is built on the New Testament and the Old Testament. So people can go back and read things, and stoning is not in the Quran.
Right.
It's in the Old Testament. But sort of like carried over. It's been co-opted from the Old Testament into the...
Right. It was such a good idea then.
And killing gays is not in the Quran. People can argue, Sam's argue, it's in the Hadith somewhere, whatever. It's not in the Quran. It is in the New Testament. The Old Testament about literally says, if they lie with a man, kill them. Like, let's not play games. If people want to commit acts of violence from any of those books... they can find a justification. It's not mainstream anymore.
Right.
And that's the fight, like, against who's speaking for your faith. And what are the... And you know, they get shouted down by the Sam Harris's and others on the right when you would bring up, these guys have a political agenda. You're not getting this. They go, oh, no, this is radical Islamic faith. I'm like, why is ISIS and Al-Qaeda killing each other? Aren't they both radical Islam? They would be together. No, because they both have a political agenda that is wrapped with theology and the way they do it. Them fighting and killing each other in Syria, to me, was the best argument we had against, this is not really about some stream of Islam, a stream of Islam, because they're both radical Islam. It's about power.
Right.
So,
well,
but we have less of those conversations now because if Trump is so in the face with bigotry that it's really about fighting against the Muslim bandits. I think it's become so less intellectual, these discussions about, oh, there might be a negative impact on the Muslim community when Donald Trump's saying Islam hates us, Trump, please shut down on Muslims. DB, I don't want to let Muslim refugees in, and only Christians, and that has actually happened, and barely is covered by the media. Under this administration, it has been, Muslims don't need a longer apply, go die in your own country. There's real things going on. So it's no longer fighting of Sam Harris over
minor... To a certain extent, I think Sam Harris, to use a term I think that Alex Lawson used earlier in the program, loosened the ground, softened the ground for this type of stuff.
Perhaps.
And I mean, I don't think he was the sole responsible, but certainly he softened the ground on...
What do you think of Dave Rubin? Have you ever dealt with Dave Rubin?
Yes. Dave Rubin and I have gone back and forth. My producer was very rude to him, and therefore Dave Rubin decided not to...
Did he used to come on your show?
No. I wanted to debate Dave Rubin, and my producer and contributor, Michael Brooks... did a video. He did not title it, I should say, because I got in trouble last time for saying that he did title it. Not from him. He took total credit for titling the video. But the titler of the video was like, I deserve credit for that.
What was the title?
Dave Rubin's Stupid. Something like that. And
I know Dave Rubin before he... I know him as a stand-up comic in the city. We were friends.
Okay.
We used to hang out all the time. We would hang out all the... I'm not kidding. Me, him, and a comic named Adam Hunter.
Now, did he really perform stand-up?
No, he did. We did. He was
I have people who want to talk to you.
Oh, no, like, but he was not touring the nation. We were at a level together. We were doing open mic book shows, some book shows, and then every now and then...
Was he ever even remotely funny?
Are there any gay people here?
You know, I'm sure he had... I mean,
was his whole act like, are there any gay people here? Is that the way he would open up his...
No, because he didn't talk about being gay at all. When I knew him, he was completely... didn't talk about at all.
Did you know he was gay?
No, he never... it was only later.
Okay.
In fact, there was another comic who was gay who would talk about being gay, and Dave was good friends with him, and Dave would never say, would reveal to any of us that he was gay. And that's his choice. That's whatever you want to do, that's fine. So, but it wasn't until later, much years later, I guess when he was on SiriusXM hosting a show on the Gay Channel, and I would bump into him. And I maybe he said, I didn't know you were gay. Like, we would hang out. Like, we would socially hang out. We literally went tanning together, laid out in the sun outside of Gracie Mansion, because we both live on the Upper East Side, because we were just comics. We write jokes together and stuff like that. And if he would have stayed with it, I'm sure he would have gotten good, because, to be honest,
really?
I met so many people who are not... Look, if you're smart enough to understand the structure of comedy and work hard, you can make a living. You can get booked.
Right.
I don't know if he'd ever be really successful or not. And it's too easy to go like, he's not funny. There were funny things.
Not funny.
He was... But I would tell you, he was not a right-wing... I worked on this pilot together with him that he did. We did this thing at NBC with other comics, a guy who now works in news more. He was a really nice guy, frankly, really nice guy. We would talk. The only disagreement we had on politics at all was with the Middle East conflict, and it was very intense.
It's all Israel.
And that's
him.
Where it came, right.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of this comes out of with him.
Yeah.
Because he was really a liberal on other issues. We would get along fine.
Yes.
And that issue so inspired, I think, instructs where he goes on other issues. And,
yes.
And people don't talk about it. And Alan Dershowitz, I think there's a point, perhaps, is Trump so pro-Israel that it makes Alan Dershowitz go, like, I'm going to defend Donald Trump because I think... I don't know
I
the
also
answer.
Think what happens is you head down a path and you find you're there and it's just like, this path is more lucrative. And
that,
I don't really...
True, that's different.
And I can go through my life and not really... Like, I think his attachment to politics is probably pretty tenuous. That it is more about, I mean, the irony is, I think for him, it's more about identity in some weird way. Like, his support for Israel becomes the defining sort of issue for him and the operating principle. And the other stuff is just like, I'm going to be part of this group. I'm going to be identified as this way. And it also turns out to be fairly lucrative because he's getting funded by the Koch brothers through various, you know, Liberty Project, whatever the hell it is. And
you see the grotesque exaggeration of the Dave Rubens, our Pam Geller's, David Horowitz and stuff, who are not, look, you're going to be pro-Israel, that's fine, but there's no need to go into anti-Muslim to be part of that. And that's where it goes into where they're not just pro-Israel. They have to
be. I got to be honest with you. I mean, to be uncritically pro-Israel at this point, and I consider myself still. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to parse definitely, but when I just like, you know, view myself, I consider myself a supporter of Israel. But to be uncritically pro-Israel, to not at this point acknowledge that the country, the idea of the country has gone completely off the rails, and they're on an incredibly self-destructive path, and you know, and I don't like, even know if I could say I'm pro-Israel as much as I am the. You know, the idea that may have existed at one point.
Isn't your one of your children named after Rabin?
One of my children's named Saul.
Wasn't there someone in your...
That was actually from a movie I made.
Oh, that's right. We talked about this. That's what I said the same thing to you. That's what you corrected me, like the guy in the movie.
It was a script
that you wrote.
Right,
I think you sent me the script years ago, and
yeah,
the character's name, right, that's what it was. That's right.
But...
That's Sam. All right, now I know who you are.
Okay.
That makes it up.
So, but I think you have to be anti-Muslim to be avowedly pro-Israel. You have to fundamentally have a lack of respect or awareness of the humanity of Palestinians.
Their view, but the zero-sum game of making people more anti-Muslim so that they think, try to get to be pro-Israel at the same time, there are hundreds of thousands of Christians living in the West Bank and hundreds of thousands living in Nazareth within Israel. Who are, and the ones in the West Bank are suffering, the Bethlehem area. My family's from right outside the Bethlehem area, and my family's Muslim, but in Bethlehem. And they're still there, and they're suffering an occupation as well. And it's the way the Christian right does not care about these Christians. These Christians are not the right Christians, because they're Palestinian Christians.
Well,
and they're descended from the original Christians. I mean, in all reality, that's where they come from.
Ooh, that's gross.
I know, exactly. How dare you?
That's so gross. But yeah, I think like, yeah, the Christian Zionists are a different, are a different ilk, but they're driving a lot of this. The bus, they're driving the bus. The bus may be, you know, some of the gas may be paid for by some right-wing Jews, and maybe some of the improvements on the bus. But the bus largely is being driven by the Christian
John Hagee's of the world.
Exactly.
I mean, it's become part of the right. And I think
that happened during the Bush administration. Yeah. Elliot Abrams was meeting with Christian Zionists and, you know, and basically pushing the Iraq invasion, et cetera, et cetera. But,
well...
All right, well, Dean.
My friend, nice chatting with you.
It's been great talking to you.
Folks, catching up.
Check out your program on Sirius 127 Progress. Wow.
Right after Michelangelo Senior on the show.
Well, like,
Progress is a weird title.
It
what
is
do
weird.
I hate? What I hate more is that the right wing, the Mirror channel is called Patriot.
Right.
And like,
why is your channel?
We're the Patriots. I said we're the Patriots.
No,
we're the ones fighting
for
America.
Anti-Patriot channel.
Anti-Patriot.
Right.
Un-American. Just call it for short. Un-American.
Un-American.
UA. What's that? Un-American.
We hate America.
We are the Patriots. We're the ones fighting for what this nation's really about, not these jackasses on the right. So,
this nation's
right.
Not
nice
really
you,
about
friend.
Being
nice
gay and Muslim.
Scott,
I'm sorry.
Nice meeting you.
All right.
Take care, buddy.
Dean, thanks, buddy. you scared him away, Michael.
No, he didn't even hear it. You didn't even relay the joke.
I'm going to debut this new sheet we made. Or this
Brendan made
new
a new shot.
Oh, the quilt shot.
The quilt shot. What's that?
It's all
it's
four
a
shots.
Shot.
It's so.
It looks like the start of the Brady Bunch.
All right. Well, let's cover a little bit. Let's cover a little bit of the sound we have for today. We played the QAnon. People, that was a little strange.
I love how the constant lying.
Scott, just a little, yeah, just a little bit. Right there is good. Right there is good. Okay, good.
I love how the constant lying makes them postmodernists. It's great.
Wow, will you look at that? I can see that Brady Bunch shot now. That's pretty crazy.
Can see it?
Yeah, that's pretty nice. Wow. I'm looking down right now at Michael. Hi, Michael. How are you?
All right, I'm here. Wait, are we back to the four shot?
What? No sound on the chat? Are they having problems with getting sound?
You looks guys like that shot is not quite ready for prime time yet.
Oh, right. Is that it? There's no sound with that? Okay.
There's no sound right. with that? When I first saw that shot, Sam, I sounded like Tucker Carlson. I was like, that's a four shot? We're all here?
I'm watching the image of that, though. It's pretty funny. All right, let's go to... do we have sound now? Are we good? Are we back in the non...
we're good sound.
We're out of that
right?
shot.
Bunch.
Yeah.
Is that Howard Fineman walking around?
Who's Howard Fineman?
No, it's not. It's this guy who looks just like Howard Fineman.
Howard Fineman, Colgate like, alum.
Who is Howard Fineman? Oh, no, I know. The journalist.
Yeah.
Okay. Is he still around?
Cynthia Nixon walked by. Yeah, no, he's still around. He shows up on MSNBC occasionally. And all right, well, let's listen to this as to Geraldo Rivera telling us why we need a wall, folks. This
you
is
ready for this, Brian?
The wall is people think of it as a structure, as something that is built and stands in front of things, but really, it's inside of all of us.
It's a psychology.
To that. Is it okay to overstay your visa? Is it okay not to go show up at court? Is it okay to come in here illegally? Is that just okay? We should just forget about it?
No.
Then how does anybody enforce this?
You do it. First of all, you do it a lot smarter. I if you want the wall I think will cut down on the Juan and Maria, the fruit picker, the babysitter, the lawnmower, the dishwasher. Those immigrants will be I think kept out by the wall, but the transnational dopers won't be. I mean, you see in I made this joke in Madison Square Garden when they shoot the t-shirts into the crowd. Imagine that was just 10 pounds of cocaine. You could shoot it over a 30-foot wall.
Catapult.
But I think, though, that the United States needs psychically, we need psychologically, we need the wall on the southern border because it was scared that the demographic makeup of the country is changing. There's so many people coming
Geraldo,
in. We need
you
some
go
enforcement.
To the boys. One thing about you.
You know, Sam, I don't want to in any way feed the hysteria and paranoia about that this that a large segment of this country has about Mexico and criminal organizations in Mexico. But I will say this. If you looked at the cartels at all, who are like a multi-billion dollar industry that like have underground tunnel networks, potentially even submarines, have like global supply chains, I like the like, it's just like Madison Square Garden shooting the coke over the wall. Like, even when you're sort of right, you're really wrong.
He did give me a great idea for my next party, though.
Like a...
Well, I just don't understand, like, is maybe what we need is just sort of a mass, like, a trip to the learning annex on how drugs get into this country. Like, the idea that cocaine, that cartel dealers are throwing cocaine over the wall with one of those T-shirt cannons.
That's
and
a new Zeta's
landing
initiative.
And people are ringing. Like,
it's gotta be see through.
Yeah.
It's just, I just, the level of ignorance that is involved in every aspect of the wall and the immigration debate is just stunning. And
but even on their own terms. Like, I'm saying, look, credit where credit is due. These organizations are incredibly sophisticated. I just like how, like, that duel, it's like, definitely need the wall and the racism. But yeah, I mean, these multi-billion dollar organizations, T-shirt throwers for coke.
It's
right.
It's pretty stunning. Yeah. And it's something that we just need the wall to feel secure. It, you know what? I mean, on some level, I think that's true.
Yeah,
of Trump
I think
voters.
That part's
I don't. I don't think that will provide that security, but I think that's what it comes from. It is some type of like, it is, there is the I think the conservative movement, broadly speaking, and nativists and xenophobes and racists, they have some measure of deep insecurity that can never be satiated. So I think in that respect, he's right.
Totally.
But we're never going to make them feel safe.
They're never going to feel safe.
There is no concept in which they will feel safe. That will never, ever happen.
No. I was actually, you know what I was thinking before, though, when you were talking about QAnon? How great would the Robert Mueller announcement be when he comes out and he's like, I've been working in secret coordination with President Trump over the past year in a coordinated effort to bring down a Muslim pedophile network emanating from the Capitol's pizza parlors. We have arrested the following individuals, Bill Clinton, Rachel Maddow, and Barack Obama. And then he starts crying, like the crying Nazi, and he's like, the idea of seeing that Jew married to that beautiful girl, the president's daughter, really pisses me off. Jared Kushner has also been brought up in the sweep for attempting to undermine the Trump administration from the inside.
I'll tell you what's going to be honest.
Those of you who have been following on 4chan saw this happening.
What's going to be super fascinating is to watch... You know, when I was in college, I wrote about Millenistic cults, right?
Yep.
Where they pick a specific day. I think there's a chorus behind me somewhere. They pick a specific day when the world's going to end.
Right.
And when it doesn't end on that day, the question is like, you know, you presume everybody goes like, "Hey, man, you're wrong." This is invariably what happens is they go, "Ah, it didn't happen this day." Because of this, and it's happening this other day, and the whole cycle starts.
So they're
again.
Like, "Oh, it didn't happen today because actually it's really going to happen on this day."
Yes,
and so it just
yes.
right.
You know, and it doesn't seem to shake the belief system of its followers. So I just like wonder about that day when Mueller gets out there, and you know who also follows this QAnon stuff is that Bill Mitchell seems to like imply this stuff.
Oh, Bill Mitchell?
Level. I think so.
We were talking about how great Bill Mitchell is on TMBS because he does like these his like anti-racism is very like, the Jews never stopped me from building my own business. Why don't you take some self-responsibility?
Right.
He buys into all the tropes and he's just all like, I walk down the street in front of black hoods all the time because I take care of my body.
Oh, God.
I love that guy. He's so positive.
So positive. All right. Well, let's do this. Which one should we go to next? We got a list here of
either the strike or ICE stuff, I'd say.
Yeah, why don't... Well, no, let's do the ICE stuff first, because the strike is inspiring and the ICE is disgusting.
Yeah, this is video coming from Now This. In fact, I just ran into one of the guys who runs Now This.
Cool.
Old friend from back in the old days. But this is a clip from Now This. The ICE officials, I should say agents, two plainclothes ICE agents arrest a guy named Carlos Urrutia. He's at the Ramsey County Courthouse. He was taken into custody after a searing sentencing hearing tied to his arrest in 2017 for driving under the influence. And he apparently injured a pedestrian. The you'll see this video. It's pretty disturbing. Here is the video.
I have a warrant.
Okay, the next person that touches me is getting charged with assault in a federal office. Everybody needs to go away. We're affecting an arrest. You need to let us do this.
You have a warrant. I need a warrant. Can I see it, please?
No.
I have a warrant.
Have a letter stating. Okay. Next person that touches me is getting charged with assault in a federal office.
Who are you?
Move out of my way.
We need identification.
No, you don't.
You're a complete stranger.
Phil. Get out of the elevator. Get out of the elevator.
Are.
We're police. We're immigration.
Can I see your
Get
identification?
Out of the elevator.
I want your name and your ID and
you're
your badge.
You're going to be moved out.
Where is your identification?
Call.
Hit him.
Why do you think this is happening? Why do you think this is happening? Everybody needs to get out of this elevator.
Get out.
Everybody needs to get out of this elevator right now.
We need your identification. You are not dressed as police officers. There is no identification on you.
Right here.
Okay, let me see.
Let's go. Everybody out.
Can I see your identification?
You're out too. You need to get out.
Don't dangle her hand.
Hey,
hold on.
Get back. Get back.
I did not get any identification from either of you.
So, pretty disturbing stuff where you had these ICE agents who apparently don't need to show identification, don't need to show a warrant, don't need to do anything. They just come scoop a guy up off the street, even to the point where the court officer was like, what the hell's going on here?
Thugs. It's gangsters. Look, it's barbarism. It's fascism. It's disgusting.
Exactly. It's highly problematic if we allow people... random agents to pick up people off the street, regardless of who they are, without showing identification, without following any of the established protocols of law enforcement. It's a pretty messed up situation. But I've got a guest here with me, sitting with me now in Louisiana, which is where we are, in New Orleans, for Netroots Nation 2018, is a... sitting mayor and candidate for lieutenant governor in Pennsylvania, John Fetterman. John, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
I think we may have spoken back at the DNC, I think, at that time. And I think you were running for Congress at that time.
No, I was running for the Senate in Pennsylvania.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, so you ended up running for Mayor Braddock, Pennsylvania. Tell us a little bit about what you can do as a lieutenant governor in Pennsylvania, first off.
Sure. Well, I in the short term right now, I can do everything that we can to make sure that we win the election. You know, I'm on the ticket with my running mate, Governor Wolf, and there's just so much at stake in Pennsylvania right now. Pennsylvania can go right to work if his opponent wins. women's access to choice in healthcare dramatically will change. Our public education system dramatically change. His opponent literally said climate change is a result of too much body heat. So there's just so much at stake. And as a member of that ticket, you know, getting out and bringing every vote to the table possible, because we just can't afford to lose anybody or leave anybody behind. And going forward after that, as a practical standpoint, I also chair the Board of Pardons and can begin to make important steps towards criminal justice reform in the state of Pennsylvania. And there's other issues from an economic development standpoint. I also preside over the state Senate and can cast a tie-breaking vote on important votes. And so there's a lot that can be done, but most importantly can be an advocate for a lot of progressive policies and issues that we need to continue moving the needle on, not only in Pennsylvania, but across the country.
I feel like the state of Pennsylvania politics has changed more radically in the past year than perhaps it did the years before, simply because of the redistricting. Is that right? I mean, is that an accurate sense or no?
I think an interesting statistic that many don't realize is that if our new congressional map was present in 2016, the Republicans still would have had the majority. They would have gotten 10 seats versus 8 for Democrats. And I think that effectively reflects the will of voters in 2016 in Pennsylvania. And the Republicans had a problem with this map because they want them all. They don't believe in fair. So the redistricting, I think, is going to provide a clear picture of what voters want. And that's going to be a Democratic majority, I think, without a doubt. And what's also important is that we're going to get as many as 4 or 5 women in our congressional delegation, which to our detriment, we don't have a single woman in our congressional delegation for Pennsylvania. So for a host of reasons, the redistricting has been very important and beneficial because it, I believe, is a fundamentally fair.
It's like a fair reflection of where the voters are. In 2016, as you were running for the Senate, did you have a sense that Pennsylvania was going to end up going for Donald Trump?
Yeah, I knew it would be really close. And I had conversations with former Governor Ed Rendell, who was very, involved with Hillary's campaign. I was a main surrogate in Western PA for the Clinton campaign. And you go right outside, like, the Pittsburgh area, and Trump signs were like the state flower during that season. They were everywhere. And I knew we were in real trouble. The Friday night before the election, Trump filled Hershey Park Arena by himself, a giant facility, on a dreary, miserable Friday night without anyone other than himself. And he really plugged into this level of enthusiasm. And I knew if we won, it would be by a really razor-thin margin.
I mean, so what accounts for that? And do you have what's your sense of the midterms looking like?
Well, I'm optimistic, and last night when I talked to the crowd at Netroots, I cited Luzerne County. Luzerne went 10 points for Barack Obama in 2008 over a war hero, a decorated war hero, and then it went 5 points. He went 5 points for Mitt Romney, over Mitt Romney, and then it went 20 points for Donald Trump. There are a lot of persuadable voters in Pennsylvania. Donald Trump did a good job of making his case and getting out into these counties like Luzerne. And we have been doing that in getting out and letting voters understand that it's like, here's what you got with Donald Trump. Here's a man that was in Pennsylvania. He was in Luzerne last night, for example, said that U.S. Steel's going to build 6 new mills. They're not building any new mills. My home actually hosts the last steel mill in Western Pennsylvania. And just realizing that it's like, look, this guy doesn't care. He used you and your town as a political prop. And that's vile, to use people or a circumstance like that as a prop to get elected when there's nothing in your background, in your life, that ever demonstrated that you give any concern whatsoever for these folks. So and that message is getting out, and it's that's what makes me optimistic. That doesn't mean that I'm willing to take anything for granted. In Pennsylvania, it's every county, every vote. I'm not leaving anybody off the consideration simply because they may have voted for Donald Trump in 2016.
Give me a sense of some of the challenges you face in a town like Braddock, because I get the sense
every challenge. We didn't have any functioning playgrounds. We didn't have any operational restaurants. We had it was dangerous and violent from a public safety standpoint, and we have successfully addressed all of those. But there's still decades of work ahead. And one of the main reasons why I ran for lieutenant governor is because I really want to be that champion for forgotten and marginalized communities. And it was galling and outrageous to hear Donald Trump using that same kind of rhetoric in 2016, because I've spent my professional career in one of those places, and he's never set foot in one of those places.
Do you think there's there are programs, a specific politics that can address and perhaps overcome the allure that Donald Trump offers to these folks?
Yeah, well, one of the first crossovers in this election cycle is unions. The gentleman running for the Republican side wants to abolish unions in Pennsylvania. And when I speak in front of labor groups or whether an individual union member, I'm like, look, you may or may not agree with me on every issue politically. That's fine. But what I do agree with you is your economic security and your way of life and your family's security is contingent on Governor Wolf winning, because he is the firewall that safeguards labor's right to organize and exist in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And folks get that. Folks get that. And they are happy to put aside, well, I may not agree with so-and-so on so-and-so, but my economic security is contingent on this election because we have a man that wants to abolish unions in our state.
And do you think that, just lastly, do you think that programs like Medicare for All and whatnot, are those resonating with these
Definitely.
Folks?
Definitely. And it's amazing and encouraging to see how much that's changed in Pennsylvania. You know, as the only Senate candidate in the country to endorse Sanders for president in 2016, to see those policies now not be more mainstream, but actually be the majority in polls is encouraging and outstanding. And, you know, Bernie did two rallies for us in 2 months in Pennsylvania, and both with enormous crowds, with enormous enthusiasm. And, you know, I don't consider it radical or progressive even. I consider it fair and basic decency and the public good. So that message definitely resonates. And coming from my background in a kind of place that I come from, I think it's important to remind voters that we're on your side economically. You've seen what Mr. Trump stands for.
John Fetterman, good luck with your campaign.
Hey, thanks for having
really
me
appreciate
on.
You taking
oh,
the time.
Oh, it's great. Wonderful beer. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay.
All right, folks. We're going to have we got one more guest, I think, sitting down. She is a candidate for governor the state of New York. I think she's making her way over here. Netroots Nation, people walking down Radio Row.
Yeah, that's Fetterman. That's my associate. What do you think of that, you little prick? You like the postal code on his arm? Yeah. Maybe you should talk a little bit more respectfully about me, or somebody might have to break okay. you. Oh, here's Cynthia. Okay.
All right. Joining us live is Cynthia Nixon. She is a candidate for governor in New York. Cynthia, welcome to the program.
Sam, nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Run into you here, of all places.
Yes.
Congratulations on your recent DSA endorsement.
Thank you.
And
so we were also endorsed by National Indivisible, which was very exciting, same weekend.
And so, all right, so give me an update. How is the campaign going?
It's going amazingly. You know, we're really in the last 6 weeks. It's the primary is September 13th, which
right.
is 6 weeks from yesterday. And we're really doing canvassing. We've got thousands of volunteers across the state who are door knocking and who are phone banking and doing voter-to-voter texting. And we're getting a really high yes vote. We're getting a 70% yes vote on the doors that we're knocking on, which is amazing.
All right. So let me ask you this. I saw you at, I think it was a like a house party early in your campaign.
Yes.
Maybe it might have been the first one. And
it was close to the first one.
And then subsequent, you know, 2 or 3 months later, many of the things that you were talking about that first one, Andrew Cuomo sort of said, like, I'm starting to feel the heat. I've got the very least paid lip service to changing some of these things. But he's done this before, right? He did this in 2014, sort of made some promises about the IDC and whatnot. What's your sense about his reversion back to the Andrew Cuomo that that he thinks is going to be, you know, a launching pad for the for his presidential run or something?
Well, right. So in terms of what Andrew Cuomo's actual political beliefs and you know are, it's hard to know what, if any, they are. You know, there seems to be no there there. There seems to be the political expedience of the moment. And I think certainly at this moment when Democrats are demanding that their candidates and their electeds be more and more progressive, he is very hastily trying to assemble himself a progressive suit of clothes. But I do think that, knock on wood, but I do think that what happened with the IDC, it's been very, very public now in terms of him calling this press conference, Jeff Klein, Andrew Stewart Cousins. I think it will be really hard for him
to reverse,
to backslide on this.
Yeah,
now.
I mean, in all honesty, like, I think like your term as governor so far has been very profitable for New Yorkers, because
We've moved him on a whole host of environmental issues that he's been long intransigent on. We've really certainly marijuana legislation is the one that he has completely reversed himself. A year ago, he was saying marijuana is a gateway drug. We came out in favor of legalization and said, really, there's a lot of reasons to legalize marijuana, but first and foremost, because it's a racial justice issue. The next day, he said, well, the facts on marijuana have changed. I think it's a lot to do with our campaign, with it being in a primary challenge. But I also think, frankly, it's an attempt for him to distract from the corruption that keeps coming to light. I mean, this spring and this summer has just been an endless string of his most intimates, his top members of his administration, not only indicted, but actually convicted on so many counts of bribery and corruption. And what we've noticed about marijuana, it's not just that we've pushed him so hard on it, but that actually there's a particular scandal. Crystal Run, this health insurance company that got a $25 million contract after a bunch of officers of the company contributed $400,000. And it keeps unfolding like layers of an onion. And it's just been revealed that actually the $400,000 that those officers contributed, they were actually reimbursed by the company. They were completely straw donors.
Wow.
So what's interesting is every time he comes out farther in favor of legalizing marijuana, it's because there's a new story on Crystal Run.
Wow, that's also indicative of the way that he came around with charter schools and Ken Langone showing up in his office, and then after a long weekend with Ken Langone, came out full force for charter schools. As you know, you were heavily involved in education.
Right, and he's just taken the spectrum, back. He's revoked their contract. There's been a vote so that they don't have broadband. They're not
right.
In charge of for the entire state. And it was also just revealed that, well, actually, they haven't contributed a lot to him lately, whereas the people that were being considered, Comcast and Cablevision, have given him hundreds of thousands of dollars this year.
So Andrew Cuomo's pay to play, I think we're going to probably hear more about that in the following weeks of the election. But give me a sense, day one, obviously nothing happens on day one.
Yes, but, that's not true.
All right. Well, then
day one.
Yeah, day one.
Executive order, expand access to driver's licenses to all undocumented New Yorkers. Because this is something that a governor can do by executive order in a single day. And it's the number one way if we really want to fight against the Trump agenda and we really want to protect undocumented New Yorkers. This is the simplest and most effective thing that we can do, because not having a driver's license is the way that ICE is figuring out who's undocumented and tearing families apart and deporting people, turning New York into a police state. And also reappoint the Moreland Commission,
right,
which was the commission that Andrew Cuomo called to root out corruption, and they were doing an amazing job until they got a little too close to him, and then overnight he disbanded them.
Right, and that and people who know New York State politics know that it's really got a real problem with corruption. All right, lastly, signature piece of legislation, maybe not on day one, and obviously contingent upon the Assembly and the Senate passing it. But what legislation or policy would you implement as sort of like the signature of a Nixon administration?
It's hard to pick just one.
Right.
But we really need to fully fund our schools. We really need to enact foundation aid. This is something that the highest court in New York State says we owe our kids, $4.2 billion. Andrew Cuomo has been ignoring this, pretending it's not true ever since he entered office. This is money that goes to high needs, low-income school districts. And this is a way to completely transform how we fund education in our state. It's like this generation's Brown versus the Board of Education. And we don't have, this is something I've been fighting for 17 years since my oldest child, who just graduated from college, entered kindergarten. Wow. We don't have another generation to wait.
Cynthia Nixon, candidate for governor of New York State, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you,
Sam.
It's good to see you.
Thanks, Cynthia. All right, folks. Back to the studio. We've lost Michael Brooks. He has flown the coop, as it were.
It's cool. We're hosting the show now.
Great. You guys. Well.
We are the show hosts now.
We did not, obviously have too much time with Cynthia. She's got other shows here on Radio Row. That's part of the setup here. But let's.
I was hoping you're going to put a bit of food in your mouth and then take it out again.
I know. That would have been the obvious. if we had just another minute or two. I would have done the spit out the steak routine, which she always asks me to do when I see her. Whenever I run into Cynthia Nixon, she immediately will just defer, like, please do it for me once. And
she does a vomiting motion, and you assume it's about your role in Sex and the City.
Exactly right. All right, well, let's go through some of this sound for a minute. I'm going to. I've got some more pre-tapes to do, so we'll sign off in about 5 or 10 minutes. Of course, we'll be back on the air on Monday. Also, folks, don't forget, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com and supporting our daily show. This is another freebie. Well, this is a freebie Friday, but we'll do the freebie Netrootsy. That's not alliterative. The no-charge Netroots. Is what we call it, right? All right, should we go to... It's Jason Miller is still around. This is Donald Trump's spokesperson, who is... Where is this this clip from?
CNN Cuomo.
This is on CNN Cuomo, Jason Miller with Angela Rye. And... Angela Rye, they're talking obviously about Ivanka Trump weighing in on the child separation and immigration. We talked about that clip yesterday. Incredibly disingenuous. But she has a brand to protect, folks. And here's Jason Miller. Folks, you better be American if you're coming to make these type of charges.
Don't understand that your president announced his campaign by talking about building a wall to keep
our president,
your president
Angela.
Keeping
he's
the, no, he's not mine, not mine. I'll never, oh, I will never you, claim a bigot ever.
Let me just finish because I know you're off on a red herring because you're losing the debate.
So let me just finish this point for you. He started
no, because, Angela,
his
you scream
campaign.
At people, you're rude.
Come on,
you
dude.
Call,
I'm not, I'm not screaming.
People.
The only person that's rude is you
right.
because you're so afraid for me to get to the comma because the debate ends at the comma, dog. This is over. You have nothing to add except for asking me if I'm Canadian. And no, I'm not. I wish I could tell you where from Africa my ancestors came from, at least part of them. But I wouldn't know because the same bigots who are sending people back away from their children are the ones who brought my ancestors here on
well,
a slave
ship. Then where?
Congratulations.
I mean, if he's not your president, then who is your president?
You want to stay on that point because
well,
it has
both,
nothing to
we
do
we
with
both
child
know what
separation.
Angela's point is. She
and
says
I'm not
she doesn't accept
that.
Trump.
Trump's politics, but obviously he's the president of the United States. Everybody knows that.
There you go.
Wow.
He's really focusing in on her rhetoric. I mean, that is, look, that is classic conservative strategy to deal with those charges. That is the aggrievement of you disrespecting the president.
And you retreat to pedantry.
I'm not an idiot.
Exactly. And, look, these are all people who said that Barack Obama was a Kenyan socialist. They had, no compunction at that time for such disrespect to the presidency. And, I have to say, even at that time, for me, it was completely a... it's a process wine, essentially, on some level. But that's all that they have left.
Yeah, and the more time they can spend talking about that, the less time they have to spend talking about Trump's indefensible policies.
Run out the clock.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why, that's the sort of the balance that you have to have in those situations. If you really want to force them to address the policies, you can't give them little toe holds, these little tiny victories of saying he's not my president, right? Like you can avoid that. But I think to a certain extent, that's the kind of stuff they like on CNN, because it really gets people like us to play the clip when they talk about, her being Canadian. And I do feel like that was a euphemism, right?
Yeah.
Talking about how rude she is.
Well, why would you know that? Why would you know she's like has some relationship to Canada, right?
Does
like,
she? Is she Canadian?
She's from Seattle.
Oh, is she? Well, I see.
I don't think that's what he meant.
No, I know. Not. I thought maybe she had like her dad was from Canada or something, and he knew that about her. So, but like, why would you even investigate something like that in the first place?
Well, I think the idea, from his perspective, is just saying like you're un-American,
yes.
Right? Like, I don't know if you are a Kenyan socialist, but you are not you're not white.
It's like third grade grammar games that they play instead of like actually dealing with the issues.
Yeah, can I use the bathroom? I don't know. Can you?
It's not technically an assault rifle.
The AR doesn't stand for assault rifle.
Exactly. You don't. Oh God, you've confused clip with magazine. What's wrong with you?
Can't even have this conversation until you get it right.
All right, this is a pretty good story, and this comes from the Jacobin. This video, is that right?
That's who tweeted it out. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. So there was a there's been a wildcat strike in an Indianapolis factory. A 30-year-old welder in Indianapolis worked for a construction contractor building a UPS hub. On Tuesday, small number of Latino workers working for a different contractor but in the same hub were ordered home after disobeying the orders of a boss he calls racist. In response, the entire group, over 100, walked out. This is pretty cool that people are responding to this type of stuff by withholding their labor. Let's play this video.
Amigos, get up out this motherfucker. Y'all got him fucked up. Look at him. They sent a couple of them home. They all packed they shit up and shut this motherfucker down. Nigga, who y'all think y'all playing with? Mexico, man, this is what black people need to be on, man. I swear to God, I love this shit. They are packing they shit up and shutting this motherfucker, huh? On my mama, all that shit. They are not bullshitting. They packed up. Yeah, I see, it's over. Them motherfuckers now packed up and dipped. They thought they was gonna play with these amigos, and they said, oh yeah, we rise together, homie. And they leaving. And they not bullshitting. Take this in, man. Look at this, man. They shut this big motherfucker down today, man. We all going home, man. The SAs, look, ain't no grinding, cutting, welding. This motherfucker dead ass quiet. The Mexicans shut this motherfucker down, nigga. Said, fuck you, bitch. And Billy, see, this what I'm talking about, baby. I swear to God, they got me here geeked up on my Malcolm X shit, on my mama, nigga. Fuck the bullshit, nigga. Look at this. They shut this bitch down. They pissed them off, nigga. And they said, fuck you, we out.
Hell yeah.
Wow. That's, I guess we should have said not safe for work, but
no, I think that's especially safe for work. But
right?
I mean, play that at your workplace.
Not safe for bosses,
yeah,
maybe.
I mean, that's pretty great to see. And it's pretty, I mean, it's just super inspiring to see people using their labor as leverage, because that's basically what folks have.
And then also to see the exhilaration of what that actually looks like when it works.
Oh, my God. So exhilarating. And I should note that there is a long history of Mexican immigrants bringing their radical labor politics to the U.S. and breathing life into the labor movement here. Like, I went to a talk during the socialism conference that was super awesome called Radicals in the Barrio. It was about just that topic. And it was by Justin Akers Chacon, who has a book out called Radicals in the Barrio, Magonistas, Socialists, Wobblies, and Communists in the Mexican-American Working Class. And I encourage everyone who's interested to check it out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, to a large extent, the labor's consciousness has, I mean, I guess maybe that's inevitable because just about everything from this country has been imported. But you know, it comes with waves of immigrants, right? I mean, back in the early 19th century, I guess late 18th century too, a lot of that came from various immigrant populations. A lot of the Jews coming over back in New York, that shirtwaist trial factory fire. A lot of those young women were first-generation immigrants. And had come from cultures and countries where there was a tradition of labor activism. Maybe that's where it's going to come from again. You know, it's going to come from a bunch of different places. But that's
necessity
pretty cool
mainly.
To see.
Yeah.
What's that?
Necessity mainly.
Yeah.
And I love it that stuff like this is going viral. Like, this speaks to people. And that makes me feel a little bit optimistic about our ability to marshal the forces we need for the fights we're going to see ahead.
Right. It's not just a documentation of it. It's how it's played in culture, too.
This is pretty gross. Coming off of that more encouraging video. Apparently, there was a case in Ohio. This happened a couple of days ago. An Ohio judge had a defendant. I don't know exactly what the guy was on trial for. A 32-year-old man. He was a convicted robber. And he was talking to his attorneys. And the judge told him to be quiet. And then it's unclear to me, like, you know, how long this took place over the course of, because it's clipped together. But at one point, the judge, and look, I think it's perfectly appropriate for a judge to say, look, if you say anything else in my courtroom, I mean, you know, in courtrooms, judges have full authority. And I thought you should exercise it judiciously, as it was. But if you've got a defendant, you've got anybody, frankly, who you've told to be quiet, they're not being quiet in your courtroom, and you have the right to have them expelled from the court. You have the right to have the officer of the court remove that individual if they're, you know, they've been convicted or they're being held. You can return them back to their cell. But this type of stuff is twisted. It's super twisted. Watch what happens in this clip. And let's just cut in. I know it's like 2.5 minutes long, but just go in like a minute and just know that, you know, the guy has been talking. The judge has basically been asking him to stop talking. But go ahead. We don't need to see all 2 minutes of him talking, but go ahead.
Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't.
No. Does the comment, quit talking,
You understand that?
Because you're trying to take my life.
No.
And you're not letting me tell you what's going on.
Take your life for what? What do you mean?
It's not fair. You're trying to take my life.
What does that mean?
Again,
I'm going to interrupt. Mr. Williams, listen to me. If we have to, I will gag you in 1 second. So listen, you will get a chance to talk. I'm going to gag you in 1 second. So just listen to me. Zip it until I give you a chance to talk. You'll get a chance to talk. I am going to give you a chance to talk. Here it is again. So you said to me you understand this comment. Zip it. Right now.
And why don't you let it play about me getting shot on the bus for a whole week? Let that play.
Mr. Williams will.
Mr. Williams, be very simple to gag you. You're
that's
the verbal.
That's a violation of the HIPAA law, Judge.
Here we go. I'm going to tape it, and then I'll unzip it when I want you to talk, because the young lady over here can't take down everything. You know how this works. We've been in the courtroom hundreds, well, at least 50 times as we prepared for trial.
I'll give him a chance to speak at sentencing.
Yeah, take me out. Now I'd like you to speak.
Mr. Williams, I want to make it real clear. If you spit down, attempt to bite, or injure any of my deputies, you're going to have a bad day.
None of that.
Oh, you clear.
Put the tape on me, man. We got this shit.
That's what it is.
We'll go back on the record. Mr. Williams will have a chance to speak.
And I'll give honor to everything I'll say.
Go ahead.
I mean, that's nuts. You can't you kick him out of your courtroom.
Yeah, but then they wouldn't have gotten to humiliate him like that.
It wasn't even effective.
No. I like it that he was still talking shit afterwards.
Right.
That guy is really the resilience of the human spirit.
I mean, look, you don't need to defend the guy's actions in or outside of court to say the court has a responsibility to treat human beings as human beings.
Yeah, with dignity. Not,
yeah, exactly.
Like
kick him out of the courtroom.
It just looks. It's just like how it even looks. Just to get on optics, which is not the most important thing. But it reminds me of in Serbia, there was this like Otpor movement that like it painted this. I can't remember who it was, but a dictator's face on a barrel, and then let people like pay a dollar or something to like hit it with a stick. And then the police came and then took the barrel, and so they got all these pictures of them sort of like leading the dictator in off in like almost sort of representational cuffs, and it was like just cops looking dumb. And it's like you're gonna put tape over a guy's mouth, and you think that's gonna reflect like, oh, this is our authority? It just undermines it entirely.
Well, that guy, I mean, that main bailiff there, it looked like it was his birthday when he had the chance to tape him. He's like,
right.
I'm gonna. If you spit on me, if you bite me, oh, you're going to have such a bad day.
But you know, it's just optics. But when you look at a courtroom, it's all about optics, right? The judge is sitting up. He's elevated. He's got the or she's got the black robe on. You know, there's a reason why courtrooms are set up like that. There's a reason why the optics play a part in the court, because that is the representation of justice. And that is supposed to say, like, everybody who comes in there has an equal, is equal in front of the law. And so when you do something like that in the context of a courtroom, it's disgusting.
Well, all that stuff is a lie, though, right? Like, we know that people are not equal under the law in America right now. And the carceral system is designed to dominate and oppress marginalized people at every turn. So in a way, that action kind of lays it bare in a way that's sort of honest, if dark and disgusting.
All right. Well, listen, folks, I'm going to have to wrap up the show right now. And I've got some pre-tapes, and we'll hear some of that, in the coming days. We will be back in studio on Monday, live, at our regular MR time, ladies and gentlemen. Don't forget, check out the Antifada, Jamie's podcast at patreon.com/theantifada. They also have a YouTube channel you can find. Obviously, you can subscribe through iTunes and Literary Hangover. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jamie.
It's a big one this weekend. We are recording an episode with Matt Chrisman in Virgil, Texas, of the podcast Chapo Trap House.
I've heard of that podcast.
We're talking about the 70s and all the ways capitalism went off the rails, never to return again in that decade.
Matt, what do you got planned for literary hangover this weekend?
Yeah, Saturday, The Maypole of Marymount, Nathaniel Hawthorne short story, which is sort of the first clash on American soil between the sort of white nationalist Puritans and the globalist Marymounters on Mount Wollaston in Quincy, Mass. So check that out.
Quincy, Mass. Sweet. Folks, see you on Monday.
I'll strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive, between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into you, while I shifted in and out.